Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now, it sounds like something out of a science fiction film, but scientists in the United States say they have developed the world's first living robot using stem cells from frog embryos. The robots, that they're calling xenobots, are less than a millimetre long and have the ability to self-heal. Dr. Douglas Blackiston is the co-author of the study from Tufts University, and he told us how the robots were made.
Our collaborators at the University of Vermont created a computer program that's built off of cells, virtual cells, and it can, through its own software, design organisms for a specific purpose. So you can ask the computer a question, design me an organism that does not exist anywhere in nature that has the following capabilities. It can move, it can maybe pick something up, it can sense something, it can deliver something. And I came up with a way to build those designs out of actual living tissue. So I take frog eggs that are fertilized. These are aquatic frogs that come from Africa. I harvest stem cells from the eggs, and then I do some genetic and molecular trickery to get the cells to produce certain types of tissues that I can then layer and create a 3D representation of what the computer has created.
What is it hoped that these little bots are going to be able to do?
I think the goal here is that there's a lot of tasks that are difficult for actual robots right now. We can make these very small so they can go places that normal robots can't go. Number two, they can heal themselves. So if you injure them, they repair themselves, which a normal robot can't do. And so we're looking at applications like sensing contaminants in water or gathering up plastics in the oceans or delivering drugs to a patient.
And what will they look like, these things?
We can build all sorts of complex 3D body plans. So we can give them small legs for walking around. We can make them very elongated for slithering through tubes, or we can build them sort of in these clam-like structures, which are capable of walking and shuffling about.
So these are living robots. Does this not raise ethical questions about just because you can, should you?
We do have a lot of discussions with ethicists, both in the university and without. And as of right now, these are still very primitive, so it would be the same as some skin sloughing off of a frog or mowing your grass. These do not have neurons. They don't have brains. They're not capable of reproducing. And so we're starting with something very simple to ask these types of questions before we get to a much more complicated or even sort of conscious organism.
So have you seen Terminator?
I have. I've seen them when I was very young.
And that was your inspiration?
No. So certainly what we're looking for is more of the biological version. We're not looking for the hard, scary skeletal robots. Now, also right now, we're starting very small, so we can hopefully avoid the Skynet situation that was predicted in that movie.
Hopefully. Are you reassured? I'm reassured. That was Dr. Douglas Blackiston.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. In some parts of the United States, the winter months can mean lots of bleak, cold days and freezing nights. So it's no surprise that winter is also the busiest time of year for tourism in the Caribbean. From mid-December to the beginning of April, the islands become saturated with tourists looking to escape to warm, sandy beaches and crystal blue waters. The Caribbean is one of the most tourism-dependent regions in the world, with some islands like Antigua and Barbuda relying on tourism for nearly 80% of their GDP. But very little of that money actually stays on the islands. According to the travel organization Leaf Group, up to 80% of every dollar spent by tourists goes to the global companies that own Caribbean resorts and cruises. Angelique V. Nixon is the author of Resisting Paradise, Tourism, Diaspora, and Sexuality in Caribbean Culture. And she studied issues related to the Caribbean's colonial legacy and grew up working in the Bahamas tourism industry.
It was a difficult experience, but at the same time, it was also an experience that forged who I am today. One of the things that I learned from a really young age is that how dependent we were as a country and as a people on tourists, you know, where our bread and butter and our day-to-day living was dependent upon if tourists came to the Bahamas. So when I was working in the tourism industry as a young person, it was just a very sort of day-to-day reality.
And, you know, Angelique, what's interesting, my family is from Puerto Rico and the tourism industry is also huge there. And I've always found this sort of disconnect between folks that go particularly to the island of Puerto Rico, don't understand that those are also American citizens. There's almost like a two-tier system on the island. Do you find that across the Caribbean? Not so much the citizenship question, but just this two tiers of people who are native to the island and then the tourists who go there to spend money.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that was something that was very, for me as a kid growing up too, you know very much that there's spaces that are for tourists and there's spaces that are for locals. And when I was in primary school, we had this program called Smile Please or Smile Bahamas, which was a tourism training program. And a lot of us in the 1980s went through it. The way that the public school system in particular, but also even the private school system kind of trains, especially from working class neighborhoods and families to go and work in the tourism industry. It's what we're trained for. There's definitely a lot of troublesome relationships, a lot of exploitation that happens because of that. And a lot of it also is about race and class, you know. And I think it was even more troublesome for Puerto Rico being literally a neo-colony of the United States.
Angelique, we know that, as you said, a lot of the islands in the Caribbean rely on tourism. But does that mean, when we say they rely on tourism, does that mean that the money stays in the island?
No, that money does not stay in the region. In fact, the reality is that much of the tourism industry is run by multinational corporations and travel tour guides and the whole business of tourism, from the hotels to the airlines to the tour companies. It ends up going to the multinational corporations, and then it also is spent, even for local companies, that we end up spending that money on importing goods for the tourism industry, right? The most terrible culprit of this, of course, are the cruise ship industry. The cruise ship industry is incredibly exploitative to the environment, to the people they employ, the very low wages they offer, and an extraordinary amount of consumption associated with the entire cruise ship industry to bring millions of people to the region. And so it looks good on paper that, you know, in the Bahamas, for example, has 3 million cruise ship passengers who come. But most of the money the tourists have already spent on their vacation, you know, and a lot of times these are folks who saved up all year, sometimes years to go on a cruise. And the reason it's cheap, the reason you can get these package deals, right, to go to several islands across the region is because of the fact that they keep their costs low and they keep people on the ship and they manage the entire business of the cruise ship experience, and often at the cost of the islands themselves that don't benefit largely from that, from those profits.
So let's talk a little bit about how, particularly in the Bahamas, we've seen Hurricane Dorian strike the Bahamas earlier this year, or last year, I should say. Puerto Rico just experienced a series of earthquakes that have been pretty devastating to certain parts of the island. When islands in the Caribbean are subject to natural disasters like this, what effect does that have on tourism going forward?
I mean, it's devastating, and the Bahamas is still recovering. I mean, it's a double bind of the tourism economy, right? Because we haven't invested in other industries because it's seen as literally the model for development, often the only model for development, for economic development and prosperity. Then it creates even more challenges for, especially for a small economy, for the Bahamas. And, you know, immediately after Dorian, we noticed that the, you know, the tourism industry, but also the government was pushing, oh, there are other islands in the Bahamas to visit. We need your dollars, right? So don't not come. And a lot of those plans are very neoliberal. They are very focused on a model of development that does not benefit the majority of the people who live in these places, but rather a very capitalist-driven model of development, which sadly isn't going to fix some of the deep social, historical, and economic problems of these spaces.
You talk about the quote-unquote myth of paradise here. And some of that is also a reflection of the fact that people go to these islands to relax, to unwind, and they aren't aware of the history of many of these islands that includes colonialism, slavery, genocide even. Is it the responsibility of the tourism industry to teach that to tourists, or can't tourists go and spend their money as they want to in what they consider to be paradise?
The tourism industry and those who run the tourism industry are invested in a particular narrative of paradise because that's what they can sell. It's hard to sell the hardships and the stories of colonialism unless it's wrapped up in this myth of paradise and something that's very watered down. And so I think that's a part of where we need to start. And maybe it's not, we can't ask the multinational corporations to do it. In fact, I think we as Caribbean folks and who work in the business of tourism need to be the ones to also challenge that. But I think we can ask and we can expect better things. And I think it's also the onus is on us as well as to be an ethical traveler. If you're going to go to a place, you should learn about it, right? And I think we should critique those narratives that make the islands interchangeable and make it seem as if it doesn't matter, you're just going to this beautiful paradise, but actually do the work of finding out about these places and learn about the place before you go there and consume it.
Angelique V. Nixon is the author of Resisting Paradise, Tourism, Diaspora, and Sexuality in Caribbean Culture. Angelique, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sandringham is a beautiful country estate about 100 miles north of London. There, today, the mother of all family meetings is taking place. The Queen is meeting with Prince Charles, Prince William, and Prince Harry. They are talking about Prince Harry and his wife, Meghan Markle, and their decision to walk away from their royal roles. NPR's Frank Langfitt is following this. I talked to him earlier this morning. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Noelle.
So I've seen this called a family crisis meeting. Is that really how this is being viewed as a crisis?
Oh, absolutely. It's a crisis. And what they're going to try to do is try to figure out a new role and respond to the couple's wishes. And I think what the Queen really wants to do is avoid a rupture here. Meghan and Harry have said they want to split their time between the United Kingdom and North America. Meghan has already flown back to Canada, actually be dialing in to today's meeting, we understand. And the couple, what they've said is they want to be part of the royal family, but they also want to be apart from it. They want to start a new charity, be financially independent. And, you know, they don't say this explicitly so much, but the sense is build a separate brand, a brand separate from the royals. Now, Meghan and Harry are known as the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. They trademarked a thing called Sussex Royal last year, which would allow them to brand products. There's no real model for this in the past, but people think they're looking to do something like what the Clinton Foundation and the Obamas have done, maybe book deals, speaking engagements, that sort of thing.
So can we suss out or can we guess how much of this is about family relations and how much of this is actually about business?
Well, this is what I think makes it such an intriguing story beyond people who would be royals watchers, and that is they're completely intertwined. Inside the royal family, it's called The Firm because it is a family business. It's a big part of brand Britain. And up until now, you know, actually Harry and the Queen have been the most popular royal brand ambassadors, basically. But what he's trying to do here is strike out on his own, and that could be seen as a threat to the brand. It's also a risk to him because without the royal family, you know, that has been his platform. And it's a little like a star of a band thinking about going solo.
Okay, that's really interesting that he is such a popular member of the family.
Oh, he is. He's seen as the most down-to-earth and the most relatable of all the major royals.
So as this thing has been evolving, what has the couple said about their decision to move away from the family?
There's a bunch of things, and they've been unhappy for a long time, even before the wedding. You know, when she first started dating him publicly, there was stuff in the tabloids that he complained was racist, and he had very good reason to say so. Meghan Markle, of course, is a biracial American actress. She'd grown up in L.A. I'll just read you a headline from the Daily Mail back in 2016. Harry's girl is almost straight out of Compton, gang-scarred home of her mother revealed. Ugh. So they had to deal with that. But there have also been comparisons, unfavorable ones, with Kate Middleton, Prince William's wife. Another thing that's going on here, Noelle, that's really interesting is Prince Charles is trying to streamline the monarchy. And Harry is the second born. He's what they call the spare, not the heir. So they're looking for a new role.
What could come out of this meeting, Frank?
I think a big question is how they balance out their duties as royals with the money that they get. They get a lot of money from Prince Charles from a thing called the Duchy of Cornwall. And there's going to be a lot of questions of trying to have their cake and eat it, too, which is where they've come in for criticism, even from ordinary people in Britain.
NPR's Frank Langford. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Noel.
Carry me back to old Virginia.
Over the summer, a Canadian Army reservist named Patrick Matthews slipped into the United States illegally and vanished into an underground network of violent white supremacists. This week, he surfaced. Matthews and two other men were charged yesterday in connection with their membership in a neo-Nazi group called The Base. The arrests may signal a change in how U.S. authorities are handling domestic extremism. NPR's Hannah Alam is here to explain why. Thanks for coming in.
Hi there.
So first off, explain what this organization is, The Base.
Right. Well, it started out as an online gathering place for really the extreme of the extreme, neo-Nazis advocating violence in hopes of triggering a race war. It made a splash because a lot of people noted that the Arabic translation of The Base is Al-Qaeda. Mm. The first time I heard of this group, I was thinking, is this a hoax? Are they trolling us with the name? Mm-hmm. In 2018, Vice News reported that the group was moving from the online world to the physical world with these secret training camps. Then a Canadian newspaper, the Winnipeg Free Press, noticed recruiting posters around town that said things like, protect your race, join the base. So a reporter there, Ryan Thorpe, goes undercover, infiltrates the group, and says the recruiter who vetted him in person turned out to be Patrick Matthews. Mm. The newspaper published its report in August, and within 3 days, authorities say Matthews crossed the border into the U.S. and went into hiding.
Do we know anything about the other two men who were arrested along with Matthews?
Not too much. The two Americans charged are 33-year-old Brian Limley Jr. He'd served as a cavalry scout in the U.S. Army. The other is 19-year-old William Bilbro IV. Prosecutors say those two also belong to the base and that they drove 600 miles from Maryland to Michigan to pick Matthews up and to hide him all these months.
So do we know if these men are suspected in any actual acts of domestic terrorism, in any attacks?
Right. And I mean, that's the interesting part. The charging papers don't mention actual violence. And that's notable because federal agencies get a lot of criticism for this by now well-documented disparity in how the justice system deals with Islamist extremists versus, say, far-right neo-Nazi extremists. People ask, why aren't you watching those chat rooms? Why aren't you infiltrating those groups? And the answer is typically, there isn't a domestic terrorism statute. So there's a higher bar for making a case against a homegrown extremist. You know, being
whereby you could arrest a Islamic extremist member for just talking or inciting violence, and the same standard doesn't apply domestically.
Right. In connection with a foreign terrorist group, same standard doesn't apply. You know, agencies typically say we don't police thoughts, we police actions. So we don't know what triggered this investigation, but authorities evidently thought that the violence they saw discussed by members of the base met the threshold. And I have to say the tactics used to build this case sound like the tactics used against jihadist groups like ISIS. You know, the movements were tracked, phone calls recorded, online chats monitored. Federal agents even staked out a gun range and say the suspects fired an assault rifle there.
Okay, so this morning there are actually new reports coming out about more arrests linked to this group, The Base. What can you tell us?
That's right. The Rome News Tribune, a newspaper in North Georgia, is reporting this morning the arrests of three other men associated with the base. Authorities say they were part of a conspiracy to commit murder. But we don't have a lot of details. It's still developing. I think the case might even still be under seal, but it's certainly something I'll be watching. I think the timing is an important factor here as well to consider. On Monday, Martin Luther King Day, There's also a big pro-gun rally planned in Virginia, and authorities fear it's going to be a magnet for far-right extremists of all sorts. A law enforcement official told our colleague, Ryan Lucas, that the three men charged in Maryland had discussed going to Richmond. We don't know if authorities worry that the guys in Georgia also might try to go. Whether the timing is coincidental or not, a sweep of arrests like this days before the rally does send a message to extremists that the authorities are watching.
All right, NPR's Hannah Alam, thank you.
Thanks.
That's right. We move into Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, hook back I.
It all started with an unlikely tip. A woman living in state prison in Mississippi was also working at McDonald's, and not voluntarily. That tip led Anna Wolf and Michelle Liu, reporters at Mississippi Today, into a 14-month investigation of the state's restitution centers. They compare the facilities to modern-day debtors' prisons, and the people kept there, working off fines and other debts, rarely know how long they'll have to stay, says Anna Wolf.
The correction department doesn't provide inmates with their debt balance, so it's very hard for them to figure out how much they're earning towards their debts and where their money is going.
People like Dixie D'Angelo. She worked four different jobs trying to pay down more than $5,000 she owed for damaging a friend's car.
I got so depressed yesterday when I was looking at that because I got two checks. And I mean, it's not even about, it's like $900-something for two checks. And I've been here 6 weeks.
This is Anna. All the while as they're working, the Department of Corrections is taking out room and board and transportation off the top. And they are given very little documentation of where their money is going. Additionally, you know, they're there to pay victims, but most of their earnings are going to pay court fees and criminal fines.
Do the victims know about this?
This is Michelle. That's a good question. We find generally that court rules across the state mandate that when someone is paying off their debts, that the court takes the first cut.
I understand as reporters, you weren't actually allowed to go into the restitution centers. What were you able to learn about daily life and the kinds of jobs that those residents have?
So we talked to more than 50 people who had gone through the program. And I think there's this misconception that these facilities are some sort of residential program. They're not. They are prisons. The people in there, their movements are restricted. They are strip searched every time they come back home after work. Even when they're at work, they're not allowed to talk on the phone or have visitors or take smoke breaks.
Mississippi's Department of Corrections, or the MDOC, declined your request for an interview. They did offer a statement. I'll read it here. It says, while individuals in this program are required to work, the MDOC does not force them to work. It merely assists them in finding employment. How do you hear this given the experiences that you found in your reporting?
This is Michelle. We found that part of the statement specifically to be extremely interesting because we combed through over 200 sentencing orders, and we found that in almost every case, the explicit language of the sentencing order said that these folks had to stay in the restitution center, had to be locked up there until they had made enough money to pay off their debts. Likewise, the handbooks that the state calls these people residents, not inmates. It doesn't consider them to be incarcerated. But the handbooks these quote-unquote residents receive basically have program rules that say that if you refuse to work, if you participate in a work stoppage, or you're even fired from your job, you can face consequences back at the restitution center.
Including going to prison.
Yes.
So you can't just say, look, I'm going to go work somewhere else and pay off the debt on my own.
No, because your sentencing order by the judge who sentenced you pretty much lays out what you're going to do under the law.
What is the argument for restitution centers? I mean, is it any better than serving time in a formal prison? Does it have any better outcome, say, for the victims?
This is Anna. We found, like so many things in government, this program is sort of flying under the radar. So there aren't really very loud proponents of this program. It's just something that's kind of perpetuated by judges, really believing that these people need to learn some sort of responsibility. Similarly, the employers think that they are doing a service by employing these folks and giving them a skill that they may not have before. But also the program benefits the employers by providing them these reliable workers. You know, they know their employees are going to show up when the Department of Corrections is driving them to work every day.
And this is Michelle. Again, I'll add, while some folks may say that these restitution centers are less harsh and less difficult than the experience of prison. One woman we talked to specifically said that it was the experience of not knowing the definitive end of her sentence that was so difficult and so miserable for her. She compared it to torture, effectively.
And this is Anna. Some even say they would have preferred to be in prison.
I mean, do you find people are there for just indefinite amounts of time?
So there is a limit of 5 years because our state law prohibits probation sentences for longer than 5 years.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. It's
right?
a lot
Depending
longer than some
crime.
People would have spent in prison for their crime. And I think it's also important to note that, you know, many of these crimes, a lot of them don't have traditional victims. So many of the crimes are related to drug addiction and poverty. So these centers exist for the poor, because if you could pay off your debts, you would not end up there.
That's Anna Wolf and Michelle Liu, reporters with Mississippi Today. Their investigation was published in partnership with the Marshall Project. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having us.
NPR has reached out to the Mississippi Department of Corrections for comment on this story. So far, they've offered none.
In the years after the Great Recession, the city of Detroit overtaxed homeowners by at least $600 million. That is according to an investigation by the Detroit News and Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their reporting finds that those bloated tax bills have left homeowners in the nation's poorest big city struggling to hold on to their homes. Christine McDonald is an investigative reporter at the Detroit News, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the backdrop to how these inflated tax assessments happened, which I suppose means we should go back to the economic collapse and the start of the recession. Just paint me a picture of quite how bad that was in Detroit.
Well, the recession hit Detroit very hard. We had a very high percentage of subprime loans prior to the recession. And when the housing market crashed, those homes went into foreclosure. And so many folks lost their homes in Detroit. We estimate that as a city as a whole, a third of Detroit properties went through foreclosure after the recession.
A third. Wow.
Yes.
So time passes. Michigan, Detroit start to crawl out of the recession, but housing prices do not go back to where they were. And you can scoop up houses for very, very little money. Who's buying?
We see a lot of investors coming in. They would sell them to people who were renting, who didn't want to rent anymore and wanted that American dream.
A lot of first-time homeowners.
Correct. People were buying these homes often without even the basics of heating, plumbing, even electrical, and hoping to make something of that home. And you add that to the tax debt on these properties was almost too much for many people to bear.
Right, because the problem that emerged and where your reporting kicks in is that the city is still assessing property taxes on these houses at the pre-recession rates. People are being handed tax bills that are very close to what they actually paid for the house.
I mean, people could buy houses at that point for $500.
And they're facing tax bills of in the thousands of dollars.
Yes, yes. I mean, our lead woman, Anna Bolden, she bought a house for like $4,800 in 2011. And her tax bill that year was $26,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So eventually the state gets involved. This is 2013. Michigan mm-hmm. orders Detroit to get their act together and reassess
Correct.
Property tax rates. And yet the debt continues to build.
Correct. Those new values weren't put in place until 2017. And it didn't help people like Candace Patterson at the time. She was a woman we met going door to door to talk to people about this issue, and she lives in a West Side Detroit brick bungalow. She's a housekeeper downtown, and she's got three children.
This is my first time being a homeowner, so it means a lot, you know, owning your own home, being a single mom, being able to pass something down to your children.
She, we found, had been assessed by the city double what she should have been. She now owes about $6,500 and is currently facing foreclosure. She's on a payment plan to pay that back, but she is very worried that she could lose her home.
It's a lot of weight on my shoulders. I think, you know, I might lose my home and I will have nowhere to go. So it's very frustrating not knowing if my house is going to be swept up under me.
How are Detroit officials responding to your reporting?
Well, they argue that there's no money to correct this and that there was a window for people to appeal these values. You could appeal, but that process was super difficult in a lot of people's minds. The past staff admit that they wouldn't even have been able to handle all the appeals if folks were aware and could do it. So they're trying some separate programs to target for low-income homeowners to wipe away their taxes, but that's not satisfying many homeowners who are upset about this.
I wonder what your takeaway is. Is there a bigger story that these staggering numbers that you've come up with in your reporting that they tell us about Detroit and how it's doing after the recession, particularly when it comes to housing?
Yeah, I've covered housing in Detroit for almost 15 years. It's staggering how we are left today feeling so much of the pain from the housing crash, even today, that there are thousands of people still facing foreclosure. They're mired in this debt. And that we, as a city, were a majority homeowner city, and we flipped to a majority renter in part because of this. And that there's just this, we're a majority Black city, and there's, you think about the massive loss of the wealth, the generational wealth, because folks can't hand this asset down to their children. And that's what Candace clearly, you know, wants to do with her three kids. And just scary to think about her losing that home and what her options would be, which aren't many.
Christine McDonald, thank you.
Thank you.
She's an investigative reporter with the Detroit News. Mark Betancourt also reported this story on Detroit homeowners being overtaxed.
When you get ready to buy a house, next thing you know, 4 years down the road, you're being foreclosed on. That wasn't in your plan. You had no idea that this was going to happen. You had no idea that 4 years after you sat there and listened to all that talk, that somebody's going to be telling you to move again. And then again, and then again, because the white supremacists are experts at making people move. If you look at the movie Shane, the whole thing with the Riker brothers is keep them squatters moving. Black people on this planet are supposed to be squatters forever.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Sarah Fenske. Few things are as stressful as bad living conditions. When you're stuck dealing with roaches or living without heat, that can affect your entire state of mind. So what can you do if your landlord isn't living up to their end of the bargain? Joining us today to talk about that is Sunny Hutton. She's a community organizer with Homes for All St. Louis. Sunny, welcome back to this second conversation today.
Hello.
And we're also joined by Kalila Jackson. She's a staff attorney at the Metropolitan St. Louis Equal Housing and Opportunity Council. That's a mouthful, better known as EHOC. So, Kalila, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
So I know this is a big question, but sort of to break it down as simply as we can, in general, what rights do tenants have in Missouri?
Well, Missouri is not a particularly tenant-friendly state. And so I think that's one of the biggest surprises that people have when they contact my office or legal services or probably even organizers like Sunny. So in the state of Missouri, really the core fundamental right, it's really boiled down to a right to have safe living quarters. And so, meaning that housing must meet certain basic standard living conditions in theory, and that when housing conditions fall below that, tenants have some rights to withhold their rent and do some other things. But we see far too often from the story that was just illustrated that landlords aren't being held to the same standards that tenants are.
And when you say they have to provide you a safe place to live, does that mean that door has to lock?
That door has to lock. You know, that door has to lock. You should not be living with infestations. You should not be living without running water. Or so what we're talking about, and these are really the floor. We're talking bare minimum health and safety issues, the types of things that if the city were to come in to try to do some code enforcement, that they would say, hey, this violates our local law. And really, in the state of Missouri, outside of, you know, illegal lockouts and some other, you know, kind of broad general protections, there's just not a lot there. So there's a lot of room for growth and improvement in our state.
Sunny, I read that just last month Kansas City passed a tenants' bill of rights. Do you see a need for similar legislation in St. Louis?
I can't say right as of now. If we do a tenant's bill of rights here in the city of St. Louis, it definitely has to have some type of enforcement. And then there needs to be some money backing that as well to push that.
Because it sounds like this is the problem Khalil is saying. The laws are on the books. In many cases, people just aren't following them.
Right.
Okay. So having that extra law might not even be that helpful?
No, absolutely not. So I disagree. So in the city of St. Louis, they have taken some steps to put some progressive policies in. But what it is that in essence, we have a patchwork. So you'll have places like Kansas City or the city of St. Louis who are trying to have robust policies to protect tenants. But on par, there's not enough, especially because state law is particularly not doing enough to protect the rights of tenants. They do a lot to protect the rights of landlords and property owners and businesses, but not nearly enough to protect the rights of everyday citizens. And I think that part of it is the knowledge gap. We assume that there are more rights than we really have.
So we want to know from you, have you dealt with a bad landlord? What questions do you have about your legal rights? You can give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at STL on air or email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Sunny Hutton, I want to just ask you briefly about the idea of the rent strike. I know it's not just as simple as saying, my landlord is bad, I'm going to stop paying my rent. How would somebody go about going on a rent strike in a way that actually somewhat protects their own rights?
I would say the first thing you want to do is pull that lease. Pull that lease to determine what is the landlord in violation of, right? So you have some legal backing for that. And when you go on rent strike, it's not just like, I'm not going to pay my landlord. It's more than that. It's important that you put that money away into a savings, or you're just make sure that you don't spend that money, right?
That's exactly right.
I see Khalil nodding. That sounds like that's a big deal.
That's the biggest thing.
Where would you recommend people put that money? They don't want to give it to their landlord. The landlord's not following their obligations. Where should they put it?
Our residents get really creative. Now, I know with the rent strike, it was very organized, and it was put into a specific account, and like a formalized escrow account. And you can pay it into the court. That's one way. Even if there's not a pending case, you can do that, and there's a process for doing that. But a lot of our residents are creative. If they typically pay their rent with money order, they just set the money order to aside, you know, and they'll just hold on to the money order. But whatever you do, don't spend it. And I know that's hard, especially because sometimes we have people who have had to seek alternate living arrangements while this is going on.
And need money to do that.
And they need money to do that. And so it really is, it does put our clients in a bit of a catch-22. But the law really, it's evolving. And the Art City Defenders brought a great case a couple of years ago that helped to refine those rights a little bit. But still, there's nothing that says, the same way that a landlord can evict you if you don't pay your rent, it's not as clear that if you stop paying your rent that your landlord still won't be able to evict you. So it's really important to hold on to that money in the time being.
I would also add to it, if you have such a monstrous landlord like TEH, then don't go at it alone. Reach out to your neighbor, start having conversations with them, and organize a rent strike collectively. Because maybe, you know, $600 out of that landlord's pocket isn't much to them. But when that $600 turns to $4,800, turns to $48,000, then you're on a roll there. They have no other choice but to listen to you.
So that gives you some power.
It gives you a lot of leverage.
I'm going to go to the phone lines. Connie is calling from St. Louis. Connie, hi. You're on St. Louis on the air.
Hi. Yes, I am a social worker, and I've often dealt with tenants to make them aware of their rights. I have dealt with landlords who didn't even offer a lease, nothing, or the bare minimum of saying what they owed for rent. And my best remedy was always calling Catholic Legal Assistance Ministry and having to go to court to the landlord. But always, always, I took pictures and pictures
to document everything.
Connie, thank you so much for that. I see Kalila nodding pretty vehemently here.
That is absolutely right. And I think in one of the pre-interview questions, they actually asked me if there was one thing that you had to tell tennis, what would you tell them? Document, 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 document. If you have repairs that are not being made, if the rent is not being collected, if there are, you know, whatever type of issue, whether it's a text, an email, it doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be a certified letter, but document, take pictures, take video so that you can show the conditions in your apartment.
Okay. And unfortunately, we're very short on time here, but I did want to ask both of you, what's a resource that you would point people to if they don't have money to go pay for a private lawyer? Sunny, is your group Homes for All, are you taking on new projects at this point, or would they be better off contacting a different agency?
I think we don't charge you for anything, right? So I think the best alternative is giving us a call at Homes for All, and we would be able to support in any way, whether it's how do I have these conversations with my neighbors. So if mm-hmm. starting a tenant association or tenant union is something of your interest, I would definitely encourage it. It's probably the cheapest thing that you can do. And then we do offer pro bono legal support as well. But I would also pass it over to EHOC as well.
And legal services and CLAM, like the young lady just mentioned, there are groups of us out here. We do not charge. And our agency, EHOC in particular, is a fair housing agency. I didn't get a chance to talk about fair housing rights, but certainly contact us, contact legal services if you have questions. And there are people there who want to help.
And we all stay in communication
we
with
do.
One
you
another.
You talk to each
we
other
do.
In these groups.
We
That's
do.
Great to know. So there's some
yeah.
coordination of who'd be
there
best. Yeah. All right. Well, Kalila Jackson, staff attorney at EHOC, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sunny Hutton, community organizer with Homes for All St. Louis. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Keep them squatters moving. Black people on this planet are supposed to be squatters forever.
Across the U.S., every year, millions of people are forced out of their homes. While these evictions are usually thought of in economic terms, a problem of housing supply and income, a growing body of research is showing that evictions also take an enormous toll on people's health. William Brangham recently traveled to Richmond, Virginia, a city with the second highest eviction rate in the nation.
For Sergeant Larry Trotter and Deputy Juan Cervellon of the Richmond Sheriff's Office.
Luke, Sheriff's Office.
This is what a typical morning looks like.
The average for us would be anywhere from 40 to 50 evictions a day.
Go ahead, put your shoes on. I'm going to need your dog be taken out as well.
They crisscross the city serving evictions.
I get there and people want to curse me out, but I understand that. So you got to give them that chance to vent because, you know, they're losing their home.
It's a scene that unfolds in Richmond more often than almost anywhere else in the country. And those evictions can stay on a renter's record for at least a decade.
In the city of Richmond, there are roughly 18,000 eviction lawsuits filed every year.
Marty Wegbright is an attorney at the Central Virginia Legal sure. Aid Society, a nonprofit that represents and advocates for low-income tenants. He says Richmond's eviction rate spiked for many reasons.
We have a shortage of affordable housing. We have a poverty rate of 25% in the city. We have gentrification. We have a history of racial segregation, state-sponsored racial segregation. So it's all of those factors combined.
Virginia has long been considered a friendly state for landlords, with a host of laws that make it cheap, quick, and relatively easy to evict tenants.
The filing fee to file an eviction lawsuit in Virginia is $58. By comparison, in Alabama, it's $250.
But that ease also extracts a real toll on the people being evicted. Letitia Lee is a single mother who lives in public housing in Richmond.
When you get that knock on the door, what is that like?
It's scary. Like, your heart had dropped and you don't know what to do. And, like, in my case and a lot of other people's cases, they don't have nowhere else to go. Like, where they're at is where they depend on to lay their head every day.
Lee works 7 days a week as a home health aide, feeding, bathing, and caring for elderly clients. But even so, she says she's constantly afraid she won't have enough to pay her rent.
They'll put it on your door and just walk away. And sometimes...
That's the notification on the door that says, you're being evicted.
Mm-hmm.
Get out.
They'll give you a certain, like, they'll let you know, like, if you still haven't paid this by this day, then you have to be gone within a matter of this time, and the sheriff will be there. And it happened to me, like, 3 or 4 times.
Lee says she's always been able to come up with enough money to avoid eviction. But she says her family is still living right on the edge.
Okay, take a big breath. Go.
They had to recently move for a more pressing issue. Her last place made her son Nyshawn's asthma much worse.
He do the inhalers, he do treatments, he do a Flonase, and then he has actual medicine he takes.
It's a lot for a 4-year-old.
Yeah, but he done got used to it. He know how to do it all by himself.
She says their old apartment had rats, and the walls and air vents were covered in mold.
My doctors even said we can't be in the apartment. We got to leave because it's a health hazard.
The majority of low-income renting families in the U.S. spend over 50% of their income on housing. That's according to Princeton's Eviction Lab. And according to Catherine Howell and Ben Teresa of Virginia Commonwealth University, that often forces families to accept substandard housing after they've been evicted.
This is a problem that is disproportionately felt by Black people, and in particular, Black women.
The pair has spent the last few years mapping exactly where evictions are happening in Richmond.
When you look at the preponderance of unsafe and unfit structures, you see a lot of overlap in the neighborhoods where we have high eviction rates. We also have high numbers of code violations in these buildings.
It really is where you live that actually may be the most important part of your health.
Stay still.
Dr. Megan Sandel is a pediatrician at Boston Medical Center who has written extensively on the links between housing and health. She led a team of researchers who interviewed more than 20,000 families in 5 cities.
We found that those families that were homeless and the families that were behind on rent had very similar adverse health outcomes, which signaled to us that homelessness is bad, but behind on rent is just as bad for kids' health and their parents.
A 2018 report out of Seattle found that mental health was the most commonly cited complaint of those facing eviction, including varying levels of depression, anxiety, and insomnia. And even for families not facing eviction, housing instability can be just as detrimental.
I have to continue to make believe that everything's okay.
Back in Richmond, Carmen Candelario has been living paycheck to paycheck for years. She now works 2 jobs, a translator for a local hospital and a hotel banquet server.
And my pictures had the dots everywhere.
The mold growing on your pictures.
Yeah.
She and her daughter have moved 4 times in the last 8 years because she says the homes were all unsafe to live in. A little over a year ago, she moved into this rent-subsidized apartment, but almost immediately, her 12-year-old daughter, Amida, started having health problems.
She had a lot of breathing problems. She had a lot of hives. She had a lot of fever, shortness, out of breath, which I thought was due cause to asthma, but we were allergic to the apartment.
Candelario complained about what she said was frequent mold and dampness in the apartment, but she claims the landlord ignored her. She believes it's still making her daughter sick and says it's caused a new problem for her.
So last year she missed out 27 days of school. Within that 27 times of her being absent, I also called out 27 times.
So that you could be home with her when she's
sick? And taking her to her doctor's appointments and picking her up from school. I'm on my last lifeline. Because if I continue to call out due to health issues, I am fired.
Last fall, Richmond's mayor, LeVar Stoney, unveiled a pilot program to help about 500 families avoid eviction over the next year. The program set aside nearly $500,000 to help tenants pay overdue rent.
Housing is foundational. It's the vaccine to poverty. And so if you are able to have a safe, quality roof over your head, and then that gives you the ability to put food on the table. That's going to help you rise up that economic ladder.
Meanwhile, Letitia Lee says she's tired of having to live in places that she says make her son sick. But she can't afford anything better right now.
Does he understand any of the stuff that's going on?
I don't think he does. He just knows he's tired of being sick. That's all he could tell me is, Mommy, really? I don't want to be sick no more.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Richmond, Virginia.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
Your schoolhouse rocking, the chip off the bus.
What students learn about U.S. history can differ drastically depending on the state where they live. A new analysis from the New York Times shows stark political differences in social studies textbooks in California and Texas, even though they're the same books with the same titles from the same publishers. Reporter Dana Goldstein spent 5 months diving into this. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
You break down these differences in textbooks along broad political lines, a conservative emphasis in Texas, a liberal emphasis in California. But what does that look like on the page, right? If you're some 15, 16-year-old kid cracking open a textbook.
Sure. Well, race was a theme that emerged in the coverage. And the way that the suburbanization of the United States in the 1950s is told is quite different between the two states. California requires children to learn about housing discrimination against African Americans and other groups. The story in Texas is very different. It doesn't ever say in these books that the suburban dream was not accessible to African Americans because of housing discrimination.
What does it say instead?
It says that some people left the city because of congestion or crime. And those types of words are racially coded often, but it does not explicitly talk about race.
How does this happen if the same publisher is putting out the same book to different states?
Well, the publishers customize editions of these textbooks for each state. So the covers of the book will credit the same historians as authors, but when you open up the pages, the content has been customized.
You write about advisory panels in each state that request modifications from publishers. How does this process work?
Yeah, so the state boards of education will appoint folks to these panels. And in California, Democrats really control the process. And the opposite is true in Texas, where Republicans have dominated the process. So, for example, a Texas panel asked one publisher, please be clearer about the influence of the Protestant Great Awakening on the Founding Fathers. They're always looking to highlight that influence of Christianity. By contrast, in California, they're saying, you know, when you mention Levi Strauss, can you mention that he was an immigrant and a Jewish immigrant? They're always looking to add diversity to the curriculum.
What do teachers think of this?
You know, I interviewed many teachers in both states. You know, they know that these textbooks are imperfect. They're always looking for quality primary source materials. You know, they'd rather have their students maybe read a speech by an American president or a letter from a Confederate soldier and a Union soldier than rely solely on the textbooks. And the feedback we're getting from this investigation that we did at the Times is more and more teachers saying, you know, I've been wanting to move away from relying on textbooks. And this reminds me of why that is important, because these textbooks are incomplete.
Why does it matter if a state wants to emphasize one portion of history versus another? Isn't that their prerogative?
It is their prerogative under the way we've set up our education system in this country, which is the federal government is very weak and the state governments are very powerful. I think it matters so much because we're headed into an election this year in 2020, and our country is so politically divided. And I think this is another way of understanding a source of those divides, which is that right back in our educations as children, we are encountering different stories about our nation's founding, our nation's legacy on really big issues like race, immigration, gender, the economy. So all of this is hugely important to shaping our citizenry.
Dana Goldstein is a reporter for The New York Times. Thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks so much, Adi.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
St. Louis's prosecutor has filed suit claiming there's a coordinated and racist conspiracy to stop her from doing her job. Good evening. Thank you for joining us. I'm Steve Savard.
And I'm Samantha Jones. Kim Gardner claims it's also an effort to get her out of office, but at least one group in the suit says she's in a, quote, frantic ploy to distract the public from an investigation surrounding her office.
News 4 investigator Lauren Traeger is looking into the details this evening. Lauren?
Yeah, that's right, guys. The lawsuit names the city of St. Louis, the police union, and its business manager, Jeff Rorta, as well as a local attorney, Gerard Carmody. He's the special prosecutor leading the charges against a private investigator hired by the circuit attorney. Now, Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner has long been saying she's been treated unfairly. The city's first African-American prosecutor, Gardner, called the lawsuit unprecedented, claiming civil rights violations as well as violations of other federal laws. Now, in a statement, she said she represents a clear threat to the police union and political establishment that are determined to preserve the status quo in St. Louis. But in response to the lawsuit, the police union points out that Gardner is set to be deposed in a criminal case regarding that investigator that was hired by the circuit attorney to work the case against former Governor Eric Greitens back in 2018. Now, the union is calling this lawsuit that was filed today frivolous and without merit, saying it was a last-ditch, pathetic attempt to avoid answerability for the circuit attorney's conduct. And actually, within just the last few minutes, we also received a statement from the mayor's office about this lawsuit. They are also calling it meritless and say they expect to be vindicated once it goes through court. Now, one big question we're still continuing to dig into here, tax dollars are being spent in that criminal case that I mentioned involving the investigator, and now additional attorneys are representing the circuit attorney in this civil lawsuit, so we're going to continue to keep asking, how much is all of this costing the taxpayer?
You know, Lauren, the lawsuit invokes the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. How does that figure into this?
Yeah, that's certainly a really interesting question because that really might catch people's attention in hearing that. That law, which was passed after the Civil War, was meant to keep vigilante groups like the KKK from violating the rights of freed slaves. Well, the circuit attorney's lawsuit says that law actually applies in the scenario involving her because, again, she's calling all of this a racially motivated conspiracy obstructing a government official's efforts to ensure equal justice. But, again, not everyone agrees with that lawsuit. Certainly a lot that's going to be fought here in court and a lot to unpack.
Well, a lot to talk about. I know you'll stay on top of it.
Yes, certainly.
All right, Lauren, thank you.
That's why we have to think as black people. Stop singing and dancing and start thinking. Thinking and reading. I say reading is more important than watching TV.
There's now a list of 100 of the greatest books by African-American women. Zora Medium's online space for women of color put the list together and called it the Zora Canon, named, of course, for the great author Zora Neale Hurston. The list includes 160 years of novels, plays, poetry, and it's considered to be the first of its kind. Morgan Jerkins led the team who put the list together, and she joins us now from our studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Black authors in general have been overlooked, of course. Why focus on women in particular for this list?
The reason why we focused on women in particular for this list is because the way in which artists are overlooked is not only compounded by race, but also by gender. Mm-hmm. So black artists definitely do get overlooked, but black women artists specifically get overlooked to a bigger extent.
Yeah, in your introduction to the canon, you say you've never seen anything like this before, which is kind of really extraordinary to think about. Why do you think it's taken this long?
You know, the publishing industry is still predominantly white, and oftentimes black women's writing is treated as a trend. And so I think it's so important for lists like these to exist so that people really don't have an excuse to say, well, where are these writings? They're here. Black women have always been creating and producing.
What do you think it shows?
It shows the revolutionary spirit of African-American women. I mean, we have a list that is spanning 160 years, which means that Black African-American women have been writing longer than they have been free in this country. And when you think about those, that time period, you know, in 1859, when Arnig, for example, the first novel written and published by an African-American woman, that was when it was dangerous to read and write if you were an enslaved black person in this country. So it just shows the resistance. It shows the strength. Most importantly, it shows the resilience of black women and our artistry.
I mean, the list spans from 1859, pre-emancipation, as you know, to 2019. Mm-hmm. Just describe a few of the works that you think were overlooked. And maybe let's go in chronological order since that's how the list goes.
Yeah, I mean, we can think of in the 1920s, There Is Confusion by Jessie Fawcett. She was a part of the Harlem Renaissance. And that is a story about how ambition and love can often be opponents to one another for these socially mobile African-American people. Another is Corregidor. That's going later in the decades. Corregidor by Gail Jones. Her editor was actually Toni Morrison. Mm-hmm. And that was a story about how intergenerational trauma plays out in African-American women when a slave master, a white slave master, was the father of the protagonist's mother and grandmother.
Is it one of these books that really kind of touched you and made you sort of get in touch with something that, you know, that you hadn't before?
I mean, I think one of them, for example, was The Red Record by Ida B. Wells. Mm. She was a maverick in terms of journalistic efforts to be writing about lynching in the South and to be a Black woman and to stay alive, to be able to document that. When I saw that on the list, I was like, I'm so glad someone put this on the list. And it definitely struck me because of the material, because of even how hard it is to write about that particular subject, but to document it itself. And just thinking about how, wondering if she was fearful when she published this at all or anything like that.
How do you want people to use this list?
I want people to use this list as a guide or a talisman, if you will, to know that in every single decade from the mid to late 1800s till now, you have works to choose from. You have plays, you have anthologies, you have scholarly works, you have novels, you have essay collections, you have memoirs, you have coming of age stories. And so there is something there for anyone and everyone. And that's what I want people to see.
That's Morgan Jerkins of the online magazine Zora. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 18, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, observations you would like to share. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share. I'll start number one. I am not feeling well. We had bad weather out here in the Seattle area. I was outside doing some cleaning. Ended up being outside a little longer than I wanted in some of the snow. I was cleaning, though. Was trying to. That's right, Mr. Fuller talks about constructive uses of time and energy. And I think that ended up having me feeling not my best. It's not terrible, just a little tired. But that is why I was tardy in getting the description posted for today's program. I just have not had very much energy. I have been in bed for 2 days, slowly starting to feel a little bit better, getting my fluids up, resting, not being stressed, or too much. Stop checking my email, that will help. Anywho, that is one. Not asking for any sympathy either, still curmudgeon. Next, correction. Now, we were talking about, I was talking about life expectancy for Black males on a program earlier this week, and I said it was at 65. That is an error. The CDC shows the life expectancy is at 72. It's not 65, but it's still substantially lower than everybody else. And I guess the caveat would be that it's not like it was 72 or it's been 72 for a long time. It was in the 60s until 2007. So I was in error. The life expectancy is 72 for Black males. But again, it is still substantially, like not even close, lower than everybody else in this part of the world. Strive for accuracy. The 2020 context of white supremacy counter racist yoga retreat Toronto 2020, May 21st through May 24. That is a Thursday through Sunday, last full week of May. Wow. Cannot wait to get to Toronto. Great city to visit. We'll have plant-based meals for the duration. That's 4 days, 3 nights. Chef Nadir will be flying up from Virginia, mentioned quite a few times in our audio segments this here evening. Chef Nadir will be flying up to cook plant-based breakfast, lunch, dinner for the whole time. She has done absolutely amazing work in the kitchen twice already. The carrot hot dogs, the cauliflower fried chicken. We had apple pie last time around. Just amazing. The tofu breakfast scramble. She just made all kinds of delicious plant-based goodies and figuring out different ways of using vegetables, parsnips, carrots, that delicious kale salad that's posted, and roasted broccoli, really simple, that was super tasty that everybody loved. Just lots of deliciousness while we were there. Looking forward to doing that up again. I'll see if I can do sweet potato pie again, although that'll be heading close enough to summer that, I mean, we might be able to switch it up and do like blueberry cobbler, something like that. It'll be summertime. Not that we can't do sweet potato pie, just saying, you know. Lots of things that can be done. I like cooking with the season, so might be some spring fruits available that we could cook with at that time. At any rate, I was reminded of Pam for many reasons today. I'll be able to say her name, or I guess this month. I feel like I've been saying her name quite a bit. Pamela Evans Harris, investor, many time guest on The Cows over the years. Missed greatly. On one of her many visits, she said, if you are a black entrepreneur, you're in business as a black person, if things look like it could go well, you know, except that shouldn't be cause for, you know, anxiety, stress, enjoy, particularly if you put the work in. But whatever, you know, your chosen field is, if you've put the work in, you're doing quality work, people appreciate that, enjoy. I had people who chimed in or wrote in, multiple folks actually, who wrote in and said, Gus, I am ready to pay for the retreat. And part of me was like, whoa, it's not even February yet. Wait a minute, the deadline is next month. What are you doing? And I stopped and said, oh, yes, yeah, some people do pay, like, they're ready to roll. When they're serious about a trip, they're ready to roll. What are you doing telling them no? Like, let's ride. And what that means is, since money is coming in now, oh yeah, we are going to Toronto. So we are not doing any of the dallying that we did last time where the deadline got extended. All of that is horrible for trying to plan a retreat. The deadline is February 29. That is it. So if you are thinking about going, $400 deposit, February 29. The full price is $660. Since we have so many spectators for workplace racism, I suspect, maybe, or I'll hope, I'll put it that way, I will hope that that means at least some of you all, hey, we are getting monstrous raises, promotions, bank account is just bloated. So that little $660 is nothing. We can pay that in one swoop. Great. No problem. $400 deposit by February 29. If you want to pay the full $660, grand. If you're doing the $400, the remaining $260 is due May 1. All of this information is on the blog. I sent out an email as well. If you did not get the email, if you haven't seen the blog post or what have you, and you would like to get the email with all of the information, you can message me untiljustice@gmail.com, or you can just go to the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. It is the very first post on the blog. The email has all of the exact same information that's on the blog post, so it doesn't really matter. That would make it easier. You can just go to the blog post and read all of the information is there, but money coming in now means, oh yeah, May 2020, white people permit, get your passport. Make sure I say that again. Get your passport. passport. That was part of why I was out in the snow. I did constructive cleaning, and I said, oh, they have passport photos right here. Let me go see if I could go do that. And I almost went that day, and I stopped and said, oh, I should shave first, because you got to have this for 10 years. I want to make sure I can look as, you know, handsome as I can, getting my Michael B. Jordan on for my passport photo, or as close as I can. So I'm gonna shave up first and then go do it right. But get your passport. Toronto. Oh, and I didn't even forget yoga every day. Forgot plant-based meals, yoga. They have many, many gun ranges in Toronto. I knew they would. So we'll see if we can do some shooting if possible as well. But plant-based meals, yoga every day, constructive exchange of views, counter-racist workshops, food workshops, and visiting Toronto in the spring. I am super excited. Come hang out May 21 through May 24. Next. All right. I said I'm not feeling very well, which I'm not. I'm doing this program on my back in my bed where I have been for the last 48 hours for yesterday's program as well, Workplace Racism. I was on my stomach for that program. I woke up yesterday morning. I rolled over to check my email, and the following is what I woke up to. It's just really made my Friday sparkling. Dear Gus, this message is private and for you only. Pause. I have said for years, I don't know if it's quite 11 years, if I've been saying this since the time that we started, but I've been saying this for the bulk of the time that we've been on. You always talk. That's my recommendation, as though everything that you say is public. Especially if you're writing someone who actually is an on-air personality. Oh, no, that's not. We don't have secret conversations. And especially, say it again, especially if it's something to deal with racism, white supremacy, those should never be private, secretive conversations. If we're talking about racism, white supremacy, the whole world can hear what I have to say on this subject. I am keeping it anonymous. We've done that before. Continuing. Was your commentary on the black female guest, Michelle Cassandra Johnson, criticizing her as a black woman and you're indirectly expressing anti-black female sentiment? Question. You have uplifted Neely Fuller's concept of VGQ on your show on the part of all black people being confused and acting accordingly in this white, racist world system. Why would you, as a black victim, pick apart your guest's personal story and equate that as anti-black male when both you and she and we are all generally thrown together in one group as just simply black and treated as such? Were you blaming her as committing black male misandry? Have you, as a black male, committed anti-black female hatred? Or what examples can you give of black men and this racist system showing or expressing anti-black female contempt and dislike? Have you specifically mentioned such examples on the Cows show? Would you, as a black male, even attempt to protect a black female in a circumstance requiring male guidance and assistance? I said, wow, I will answer some of these questions. Some of these questions I will not. This is forever. Make sure I'm being heard. Anybody, if your conclusion is that I hate black females or have hatred of black females, please refrain from listening to the context of white supremacy. That is my response to that question forever. I have been asked that question before. This specifically, where I didn't have 1,000% agreement with a black female victim of racism, and somehow that became, do you hate all black females? I didn't even say that I hated Michelle Cassandra Johnson. I don't think it's in the archives that somebody heard me say that. Speak up. But I didn't even say that I hated her on the program. But somehow, even the question to come up, do you hate all black females? And I've seen that before. Like I said, something I would hope even if we don't agree with one another, it does not have to immediately go to such an extreme. Like, wow, do you have any evidence to support that? Hatred of all black females? Really? Again, the same thing I said last time. I said, wow, that's interesting to go to the prenatal certified yoga instructor and say that you hate black females. But anyway, let me go through the questions that I am willing to answer. Criticizing her as a black woman. I did not criticize her as a black woman. That is false. What I did was read portions from her book, particularly the final portion. And I even want to stop before we... Michelle Cassandra Johnson was here for 2.5 hours approximately. We did not talk about any of that until about the 2-hour, 20-minute mark. So for the first 2 hours and 20 minutes, was I articulating black male hatred? Was I criticizing her? Was I hating her as a black female? Calling her names when I was muted, sitting around calling her a hussy and things? Was that happening? Anyway, what I did specifically was I looked at examples in her book, Skill in Action. She talked about her life experience, and she talked about being stopped by enforcement officials in 2017, close to when two black males were killed. I said, you don't even name the black males. Miss Johnson in her book talked about invisibilizing. That was the term she used. Not seeing the same thing they just talked about in that clip. Not seeing black people. They're not heard. They're not seen. They're not given the same platform to articulate their views. You just spent a lot of time, importantly so in my view, talking about that in the book. These black males that are murdered don't even get identified. And then on top of that, the year is inaccurate. She mentioned on the program that she was referring to Philando Castile and Alton Sterling. They were murdered in 2016, not 2017. So at minimum, we should strive for accuracy, what I just said, and I hold books to a higher standard. Books are read and reread and edited and re-edited, and sometimes you have multiple people come in and read a book and check it over. At some point, I would think, and I am a freelance journalist, I have made thousands of dollars for writing about racism. One of the things your editor will often say is, can you give more detail? Ta-Nehisi Coates said that when he was talking about his book, Between the World and Me. Can you give more detail? Can you give more detail? You don't just want to throw things out and have people assume that, you know, that they know what you're talking about. Can you give more detail? Can you give more? Can we at least get their name? And particularly, I heard, unless I'm wrong, if I'm off, please correct me. I heard when Sandra Bland was murdered, black female, however it happened, the hashtag was say her name. Tacky Hillary Clinton even did a roll call with that when she pulled out all of those black moms to try to get in the White House before she failed. She even did that. If it say her name, why wouldn't we at least identify these folks? That was one thing I pointed out. Starting the book with the biggest cheerleader in my life is my former white husband. In fact, I can even give you extra detail on this that I didn't share. I got this book from the white woman who hired me to teach yoga. She has a signed copy of Michelle Cassandra Johnson's book that she loaned me to read before I was even hired. So I'm sitting down, literally, at the yoga studio. I'm reading this book, and the white woman is sitting, like, right in front of me. If you can imagine, you're at a dinner table, and you have the person that's sitting right across from you. So she's sitting right there. I'm reading this book. So I'm reading, yeah, biggest cheerleader in my life, white husband, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then you literally, you flip down 3 pages from that, and it's black father wasn't at my birth until child support enforcement intervened. Wow. That's not a critique. And I think I said on the program, that could just be, hey, that's true. That happened. But she said on the broadcast, Miss Johnson, I married a white man. I have thoughts about that. My parents had me in one of those upscale schools. I was the only black person there. And that was my social life for my formative years as a child and how much of an impact that had on me. And, you know, maybe that impacted me marrying a white person. I didn't call her a hussy or a whole lot of names around that. I said, hey, we in the program with conditioning has been conditioned. Victims of racism. That analysis was not applied to her father. She didn't even give any extra details about dad in the book other than child support enforcement had to make him be present for my birth and he married a white woman. Feverish, of course. Every single black male in the world is feverish. So this was not a critique of her personal experience. This is pointing out patterns, some of them where it's just inaccurate. Now, if that's a critique of her experience where you don't even get the year correct for these black males that died that we allegedly care so much about, well, then fine. No problem. Next. Why would you, as a black victim, pick apart your guest's personal story and equate that as anti-black? I said black misandry. I didn't say anti-black male. I said it's a representation of black misandry because you don't even get the year right for when they die. They can't even be identified. When we just talked about that, we just talked about, say, her name. The only thing I have to say about my black father is he wasn't here except for child support enforcement and he married a white woman. When I do have an understanding that we're in a system of white supremacy racism that produces these types of behavior, or at least I have that analysis with myself, that is not applied to her father. And I believe Michelle Cassandra Johnson did not say I was not being a hater to her. She did not say I was being a sexist, a misogynist. She said that could be right. That was not my conscious intent to portray black males in that way, but it could have happened. Next. Were you blaming her as committing black male misandry? I don't know what blaming means. I'm just saying to me, the evidence seems pretty strong. This would be another example. The same thing I said with Pamela Evans Harris. Black Love is a revolutionary act. Still the worst book I have ever read. And it had some of the exact, and I mean exact, characteristics where it was not even accurate. The term I used was sloppy because it's so inaccurate consistently. And cursing black males, name calling black males. Like, my gosh, it was some of the exact same patterns in terms of how black males are represented and being feverish. Of course, they're all chasing white women. Next. Have you, as a black male, committed anti-black female hatred? Evidence. Like I said, I don't have anything to say about that anymore at all. If that is your conclusion, Gus T. Renegade hates black females. He is just brimming with hatred of black females. Please refrain from listening to the context of white supremacy. Next. Ooh, get your pen. What examples can you give of black men and this racist system? I don't say black men. I pointed that out earlier this week. That is part of the problem at some level. You don't have black men. You don't have black women. You have, what did we say this week? You got boys and gals. That's what you got. The only man on this planet is white, classified as white. The only woman on this planet is classified as white, following logic. That's important because I got to get to the rest of the email here. But get your pen out. What examples can you give of black men and racists in this racist system showing or expressing anti-black female contempt and dislike? Have you specifically mentioned such examples on the cows? I'm not giving you an exhaustive list because we've been here for 11 years. But I'm happy to stand by my work. Let's get started. July 30, 2009. Victims of white supremacy, all females, spoke on the program. Cree 7 was on that broadcast. Now, Gus T, he's slick. You got to watch him. I didn't have exclusively black females on the program. Some of the females were non-white.
non-black. So that could be some of my hatred of black females sneaking in right there, you know, not making space for more black females to articulate their views on this subject. It's in the description specifically for the program. This broadcast is being done because a number of females articulated that they feel they would have an easier time countering racism if they were male. We didn't even take male callers for the first portion of the broadcast. Next, get your pen out. Danielle McGuire, 2011, white woman. We talked about her book At the Dark End of the Street. Now, one, that's not what this program was about. Black females being mistreated by black males. What this program was about was, oh, a big part of the so-called civil rights movement was black females being raped. And black males showing a little black self-respect and saying we're going to try from a very weak position to do what we can to stop this. Now, after she left, some of these points did come up again about black males not protecting black females and that sort of thing. Danielle McGuire, you can listen to the program. Listen to the whole thing because that is an important book. And then listen to the commentary after she departed. Pam is in there too. Well, this one I can't give you an exact date. Because there are many programs where we talked about the Boondocks. Gus T. Renegade, to my knowledge, is the only person who has said, wow, the Boondocks seems kind of anti-black female. We talked about that repeatedly, and that's not one that I went reading other people's scholarship. That was just my own analysis. They have very few black females on the show, and their representation is generally very poor. The representation of black people on that program in general is very poor. But the black females, especially so, and because they're so lacking. But we discussed all of that in detail. Or I was leading, and I even had some folks who wrote in later who said, wow, I hadn't thought about the Boondocks as being anti-black or just their portrayal of black females. I think that's correct. Next, I only saw this one because I've been in bed all day and I am, what shall I say, spoiled. My bedroom has lots of bookshelves built into the walls, which I love. I don't have to have all that space for bookshelves, and I still have all of the space in the room without the bookshelf taking up extra space. Since I've been on my bed, I've been right in front of a bookshelf. So I've been looking at these books all day long. One of them that I've been looking at, They Raised Me Up, A Black Single Mother and the Women Who Inspired Her, Carolyn Marie Wilkins. 2013, November 2013. Go in the archives. I'm even going to give you an extra one. The Not Protecting Black Females. I'm not giving any examples of protecting black females. If that's your conclusion, that Gus T. Renegade, he hates black females, and if a black female needed guidance or protection, I would trip her and run, or whatever you think. No problem. What did I say before? Please refrain from listening to the context of white supremacy. I do want to say, just yesterday, we had Neutralizing Workplace Racism. I think the first email, maybe it wasn't the first, I'm going to say it was the second. The second email we read on the program was about a black female having trouble getting access to the lactation room on her job. We have been corresponding for months on workplace racism. But again, that's probably, yeah. The extra one I'm going to give you is Mark Crutcher, Maafa 21 filmmaker, suspected race soldier. He was on the broadcast in 2009. He's been here for a long time. So Mr. Crutcher was on the broadcast. Cree 7 dialed in to ask him a question, or several questions, actually. And I did what I always do. I pressed my mute button. Same thing I've been doing for 11 years. I pressed my mute button. Mr. Crutcher did what he did. He practiced racism, white supremacy, and got rude and testy with her, which I love when that happens on the program, when white people start to get emotional and rude and nasty and not answering questions. Race soldier, be a race soldier. Keep it tacky. I'm muted. I'm listening. She's asking her questions. When he finished with his tacky response, I went to her and asked her, did he answer your question? She said no, and went back to ask another question, and I did what I always do. I hit my mute button. We had people in the chat room. Oh, I despise the chat room. We had people in the chat room who said that was an example right there of Gusty Renegade not protecting black females. He's a no good coward. He didn't step in to look out for Cree when Mark Crutcher was being a no good racist, and you should have stepped in and, you know, set him straight. That would be one where people concluded that before. Obviously, that did not change my conduct, because I do the exact same thing now that I did then. When a male or female gets on the line to ask a question, I hit my mute button. The last thing I'm going to say about that protect thing, that's what I mean. That came up when we read the worst book I've ever read, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I'm just reading the comment. This is from Seta V-E-N-P. This is on SoundCloud, Cows, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, number 8. This person wrote, a woman wants to feel be protected by her man, period. You can't say black men can't defend their women because of racism, but then say black love is a revolutionary act. What woman wants to be in a relationship with a man that can't protect? There's that word again. The only man in the known universe is classified as white. The only woman in the known universe is classified as white. Black males cannot protect. Matter of fact, let's do this. Any black male that's here that can protect himself, make sure you're the first person to dial in. I'm not worried about anybody. I got it. I wish a Daniel Holtzclaw would come around here. I wish an Amber Geiger would come in my house. I wish a Daniel Pantaleo would come here and try a choke hold. I wish the white supremacists would hop that Canadian border and come on my block. Any black male here, you can protect yourself. Make sure you're the first person to call in. That's facts. And why that keeps coming up for these specific segments about black males protecting black females. If we go mention Eric Garner, Eric Garner has public police reports where he said he couldn't even keep white people from digging into his rectum on a public New York street in broad daylight. Black males, Gusty, you put my name at the top of the list. We are not protectors. That's great. You can try whatever you want from a weak position. But just understanding the system of white supremacy, racism. Black males are not protectors. We can all do what we want from a very feeble and weak position, but understand that. Matter of fact, that black male who just died in the parking lot in Florida, got shot, protecting, that's what I mean. And does anybody, folks, remember his name? Do people go out and cheer and celebrate him and sing his praises on a daily basis? Make sure we're being logical. Logical. With expectations, presentations on white supremacy racism. I can only conclude the black misandry, anything that is promoting the dehumanization, disregard for black males, discouraging accurate discussion of black males, is hugely important, because every time it gets brought up, almost, it's the same type of responses that you hate black females. Black males and black females did this when we talked about Pam. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, that book specifically. I can only conclude it must be important. It must be something worthy of being discussed. Anywho, as I said, I am not defending the hate black females thing anymore. So hopefully those folks, you can find another broadcast, create your own broadcast, or find something better to invest your time and energy in. All I have to say about that. I did get one other email I am going to mention, because it was, man, not pleasant emails to be ill. People were messaging me. It was not, I hope you're doing better, and that sort of thing, or recommendation. It was just lots of this type of thing. So the next message I got was, Brother Gus, I think you and I can agree that the bootlicking Uncle Tom Sambo is the biggest obstacle to black liberation. I didn't even know how to respond to that one. I said even less to that one. I couldn't even. You lost me at black brother. I don't even. Anyway, if you could take about 5 minutes, whatever comments you have to share,
that would be grand. Make sure that everybody else gets at least one chance to speak. Please don't wait till the last minute. If you think you have commentary to share, that would be grand. The program has always ended at the same time, midnight, 9 p.m. Pacific. If you've not spoken at all, don't wait until we have 5 minutes and then decide that you are ready to dial in with about 15 things to say. If you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. If you know you are in a noisy environment and you have other people around or you have the television on or whatever it is, use your mute button. Get to a quiet area, quiet as possible. Share your commentary and then use your mute button. Just helps preserve the quality of the broadcast so we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary disruptions, audio disruptions. For this broadcast specifically, if we could not use metaphors, that would be appreciated. Racists, they will regularly invoke analogies and comparisons, and sometimes they will insist that it's too separate concepts, entities, they will insist that they are identical, exactly the same. Frequently, that is not the case at all. Victims have been exposed to this misconduct for a long time, myself included. Many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our thoughts, views. We will switch, use, insert an analogy of some sort. Frequently, that just causes a lot more confusion. If we could be direct, specific about what it is we would like to say, that would be appreciated. Number again is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, hussy is one of my favorite words. I rarely get to say it because of the no name calling thing, but wow. I would say hussy all the time. if I was not trying to be codified, I would be making up new ways where I could call people hussy all day long. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, maybe the switchboard will cooperate. I'm trying. We'll get it to work here and we'll start. There we go. All right. First few folks who dialed in. If you have comments, questions to share, line should be open. Oh my goodness. If I could pause from hating black females for a second, my goodness, we have, a new mommy is with us. Congratulations. Very happy to hear she and, new one are safe and happy. That is spectacular. Get back to doing my hating. Folks who dialed in, if you have hands up, proceed.
Abby?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Ohio, and I hope you can feel as good as you can, Gus. We actually haven't gotten any snow in Ohio, oddly enough. But comment on the rent situation. And I know when I was in Nevada, I also felt like Nevada was more of a landlord state, or laws gearing towards helping landlords and not necessarily the tenants. And that's not just something from my own personal experience, but other victims of racism, primarily black people. But what I had done, and I feel like I spoke about it briefly on the show because I had to go to a, was trying to look up different ways of correcting or attempting to correct the situation that I was in with the apartment that I had. There was a insect problem. There was a neighbor problem. Had to actually call law enforcement officials on the upstairs neighbors because there was a lot of arguing and physical fighting. So among other things, even like repairs and stuff like that. But of course, not as bad as the ones in the segment where I didn't necessarily have at least no mold growing on the walls or what have you. But what I was able to do was I looked up in on the like the state website, and they actually offered pro bono advice for tenants to kind of get answers or, give advice on how to start the process of either stopping eviction or getting the problems corrected. And I remember one thing specifically was, of course, the whole not spending the rent, putting in escrow or something like that, but making sure if you are reporting issues with the apartment or wherever, that you actually send them a certified letter. The place that I live, you can report issues on their website, but that didn't actually follow the state law as far as the landlords having to, or the company, because there's no longer like just a one single person. These are like, national conglomerates, basically. But if you just put it on their website, they don't really have any time frame. But if you send them a certified letter, they have a time frame. If they don't actually resolve the issue within that time frame, you send them another letter. And then at that point, you can then break your lease without any fees, because in Nevada they do charge like an early termination fee, which I'm not sure. I'm assuming that varies from state to state. But should someone have that type of issue, definitely look into like any state or city offices, see if they offer any type of pro bono work to help out tenants. And I'll mute my line with that. Thank you.
Much obliged. Red in Ohio. Viva Las Vegas. That is so important. I thought the rent, I was stunned because it was so many of those. I was confused at first. Like, did I just download the same thing four times? And I was like, oh, wow. It's four different reports all on the same thing. Like, wow. Mr. Fuller, keep those squad. I could have just played that over and over and over, but that is spectacular. Have that. And I think when you talked about not just going on the website to fill out if there are repairs that need to be done or whatever it is, sending them a certified letter, my suspicion is that they are going to respond to that very differently. That's substantially different than you just going on the website and writing in, where they might check it today, tomorrow, beginning of next week, who knows. Them getting a certified letter, like, whoa, this nigger is serious about this. Like, wow. Doesn't mean that they're going to be perfect, but I suspect that that registers substantially differently. More importantly than just, filling out what you can do both. Even they say they want you to fill out that, do the website, and then send the certified letter. But I think that's awesome. If there are any sort of resources to help, because so many of us are in that position, keep those squatters moving. That's another one, pooling resources and sharing. That's kind of a regional thing too, unfortunately, because that's going to vary, sometimes depending on what county you're in, not just, the state, but that would be another one up there, right, with workplace racism and education, that yes, working with other black people, making sure you know your rights as a tenant or a homeowner. Excellent information to see if all of us can learn more about that. Let's see. Other folks dialed in, have a hand up. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hi. I wanted to comment on the just the clips. I like the clips from Neely Fuller that you threw in. So let's keep the squatters moving, because that's actually how they do, especially with the us owning homes, owning properties, renting, because we're always unsure of what's going to happen. So we're not guaranteed to maintain our homes or units, apartment complexes, whatever it is we're living in. And also the clip on the, Meghan Markle and the prince, and how they're going, striving to, I guess, go to Canada and kind of separate. I thought it was entertaining. The newspaper article they write about her, it's like they're straight out of Compton. Like, I just thought that was so rude, but that's how they really look at her. Like, she's just some hood rat from Compton with tattoos, just invading England. And then I think of the headquarters of England, how they used to ship the slaves from there all over the place after they fattened them up or trained them how to be slaves, perhaps. And you, how you over here hating on the black women or black females, because they're not women. I remember... You had
a female hater. You had Scheherazade Ali on the program. She's just talking about whatever she was talking about. A young man got on there, couldn't speak. He wanted to say something about whatever she was. He wanted to ask her a question about perhaps black females, and he didn't even get to talk to her. He was just saying what he wanted to ask, and the women chewed him apart on the program. On this program, they ripped him completely apart. All he did was wanted to ask a question. So I don't understand how come when we have questions about black females, regardless of what it is, if they feel some kind of way, that they can just turn it around on you, the black male, and make it seem as if you're anti-black female because you're asking a question or making a statement about something that we may or may not do. It's, we'll rip you apart and then blame you and then misquote you. So I'm sorry you have to endure that. And I agree, anyone that feels that way should discontinue listening to the program because it's way bigger than that. That's so petty and small and so many things going on in the world, like keeping you alive. You can't even maintain the date. Just to show you how much of a victim you are. We don't even retain when you die. We don't retain. It's either our way or the highway a lot of times when it comes to you. So I apologize that you have to endure that with us. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Bay Area mommy. Keep doing great work with your brilliant offspring. No apologies needed. You didn't, no apologies needed. You didn't do anything incorrect. Let's see. Make sure I didn't forget. Any black male, you can protect yourself. You're supposed to be the first person on the line. We better not have a black male. Oh, yeah, I can. And I demonstrate this every day. I protect myself. Make sure you get on this line. Let us know how you do it. That would be great, too. But any black male, you're able to do that in a system of white supremacy, which is not even logical. But let's hear it if that person exists. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Give me a second, get myself together.
May 21 to May 24, we are going to Toronto. Get your passport and take a really nice photograph because you will have it for a decade. So make sure you are feeling good. Lots of black self-respect so you can take a great photograph and we'll pull that passport out and you'll feel good every time. Then you can get lots of stamps, do lots of traveling. They keep saying you got to have that to even do domestic traveling. So, yeah, that's, you need to get that for a lot of reasons. Get your passport May 21 through May 24. May 21 through May 24. That's Thursday through Sunday. Going to Toronto.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing? To the callers and everybody. I was thinking about getting the certification for the yoga instructor, but I want to do it online. What do you think about that?
Wow. That is amazing. More black yoga instructors. More black yoga instructors. Online. You could do that.
Because I looked it up, and they say the greatest people who do yoga, the yogis, they're not even certified. But I want to be certified so I can, you know, if just in case if I want to work somewhere, I'll create something where I can get some money with it.
Right, for sure.
But I don't want to go to a place anymore because I went to a couple of yoga studios, and I didn't like the vibes. There was too many white women.
Feel ya.
And I didn't feel comfortable at all. So I was like, I'm not going back there. And it was like microaggressions against me, so I didn't want to go back.
Michelle,
so I was like, I'm gonna do this online.
So sorry. Do you have more? I'm sorry for interrupting.
My bad.
Michelle Cassandra Johnson, she did say they are all macro. Any incident of white supremacy racism is not minor, and I agreed
emphatically. That said, I totally understand that. The only caveat that I would add is with like teacher training, there are some things you would kind of have to be there. Like, because some of that is very hands-on. Yes, some of that is very, I think that's a metaphor. Some of it is literal. Well, it's not a metaphor because it is literally. You have to put your hands on another person's body, and you might need someone there to see, like, where are you putting your hands? Where are you putting the energy at when you do this? Like, it's quite a few things that, you know, become very hands-on. That would be a substantial, like, I don't even know how you would do the hands-on adjustments online. Like, do they do that? Did you look at that? How do they do hands-on adjustments?
I wasn't sure. They said they have people you could call, and they're always available for help. Video chat, basically. Hopefully they look at that.
If they have people, like, in your area that are, I don't know what part of the, let's say I was going to do this in Seattle. So if there were other people in Seattle that were close enough that we could meet to practice teach together, take turns and such, do adjustments. If that was there, then I'd say, but even then you would still need like the instructor person there to watch to like, are you doing this correctly? Where are your hand? That sort of thing. Like, that would feel like a major trade-off. Like the rest of it, I think you could probably, some of the, and the prep, at least for me, it was a lot of, like, for prenatal, when I got my, the hating black male who got his 85-hour prenatal certification, we had to take class with pregnant women, because there were no black females there. We had to take classes with women every day, sometimes multiple times a day. That cannot really be easily replicated online, I don't think. We had to take a lot of classes just for the 200-hour too, but I mean, there would be something substantially lost from, because like we practiced together almost every day. We did teacher training. We practiced taught a lot. We did adjustments. That would be, sometimes you'd spend a whole, like if class is 3 hours, you might spend 90 minutes of it just taking turns doing adjustments. Like that was a lot of time. Like that would be a substantial trade-off for the online. I'm sure it's probably cheaper, right? How much is the online program?
It varies, but it's between somewhere between, you could say, $400 to $600.
Yeah, see, that's way cheaper. That's, I'll put it this way, there would be trade-offs. I think it would be a substantial loss with the adjustments and people being able to like see you practice and that sort of thing, but it would be a lot cheaper.
I'm listening. Go ahead.
Oh, and I say also, you can compensate because they have like individual workshops, right? That are like just for a weekend or a day. That'll be just adjustments, right? So, that's like, I feel like that would be a glaring thing that would be, ooh, you kind of miss out a little bit. But you could get that certification and save a lot of money because at studios, oh my God, they charge $3,000 to do a certification program. My certification program was $2,500, like they charge a lot of money. So if you can spend $500 and get that certification, and then you can go spend like $100 just on a weekend workshop or something with the adjustments, hey, that's great. You'll have it in your pocket. You'll have it with you. And then if you want to go out and work, do a studio or something like that, you'll have it. You'll be ready.
I think that's what we might have to do. That sounds like a plan right there.
I'd be curious because I don't know anybody who's done an online certification program. Like, if I could, I'd like to see the syllabus. I would be very curious. Like, I'd like to see the syllabus, and you know, if you could update, I'd be very interested because I don't even know what that would look like.
I got you. And I was thinking about just because I live in a very deprived neighborhood, very, very, and a lot of black people need yoga. I've said this before, and I think I'm going to just practice with black youth. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to get my nieces into it and try to get them certified too, because you could become youth yoga instructors. I didn't know that.
taught yoga myself, and it was all non-white instructors. It was a black female. I called her a hussy the whole time, and a non-white male. And we taught yoga in the park to all non-white children. It was targeting black children exclusively, and it was so much fun. We had cows listeners who came out. It was, and we got paid for it. It was best time ever. Best time ever. Like, and they enjoyed it. They got into the postures, and they were so excited about it. Like, that is spectacular. Like, do it and take pictures. Like, I, if there's anything I can do to support that, that's awesome. Teach more yoga to black people, black children.
I'll email you if I need any instructions or anything on you, like, you know, further.
That is awesome. You'll have so much fun. We loved it. That was one of my best, like, teaching. Well, the retreats, obviously, but being able to teach to black children, like, throughout the summer, that was awesome.
Yeah, I'm thinking about going to the retreat too, and I'm getting my passport, and I think everybody should get it because I've been hearing that everybody in my family has been telling me to get my passport for the past 6 months, and every time I come to the show now, I have to hear you say it, so I'm like, okay.
I love it. I pay attention to things like that. I guess it's been, see, I've been talking.
Alignment.
I pay attention to things like that when you keep getting the same message and then you start getting it from different sources. Oh, man, that's something to pay attention to. Like, the creator is amplifying that signal for a reason.
I'll be in my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, sir. Get your passport. Other folks who dialed in, we still haven't heard from a black male who is capable of protecting himself. That's important. Oh, let's see. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I hear black males tell me all the time that they're men and they can take care of themselves. And it's not even worth the argument. I'm like, okay. So wait until the police come or something like that and we'll see. But the critique that I guess the person thought that you was giving the guest, I looked at it like, you know, she had admitted to having a white ex-spouse who has continued to keep her in his life as her life partner. She has white friends. White people like her work, her book, you know, in particular, and the mixed race, the adopted brother. I think you could have been much, much tougher on her. The question is, if you really wanted to, I mean, I think it was a pretty easygoing interview. I mean, you weren't tough on her at all. The organism part, very interesting. You have this thing called Cynthia, S-Y-N-T-H-I-A, and it's also called mycoplasm, microcryds, or something like that, but... you know, that was one of the things they're using. Also, this field of science called synthetic biology, which encompasses a lot of different fields of science, but biotechnology, genetic engineering, molecular biology, systems biology, biophysics, biological engineering, and a whole bunch of other ones all fit under this field. All advancements of the field of science called eugenics. But can make another organism out of nothing, plastic even, you know, the science of white supremacy. Detroit taxes, overtaxing the poorest people in Michigan. You know, they already bankrupted the city. They got a commercial that says 40% of Detroit doesn't have street lights, you know, and they're overtaxing people. What I would like to know is, I'm sure people have lost their homes due to tax default or whatever. What's the compensation going to be for those who were overtaxed inadvertently and then lost their homes, you know? Is there going to be some type of recourse or reparation for those people? And I'll mute my mouth for now. Thank you, guys.
What's the compensation going to be? Excellent question. Excellent question. Not by accident either. Over there, they got, like I said, we had NDB Connolly on the program. He had his book on white supremacy, racism in Miami, and specifically the long history of white people. They just refine and get better and better at taking property from black people. And on that program, I said, they just add more. as opposed to, he brought up on that program I thought was important, he talked about Black Wall Street, since they've been talking about Tulsa, Oklahoma, since they found the mass grave site. He said a lot of that was, yes, they killed lots, hundreds, probably way more than 300 black people, but they also stole a lot of black property. Easy. Just go in. We've killed them all, ran them off, whatever. They're not coming back. Snatching up deeds. Big time property theft in addition to all the rest of them. He said that gets minimized. But I said then, they just get better and better. We don't have to do all that. Run out the Negroes, shootings and all that. Then we have to talk about it for the next 100 years. We just overcharge them on the taxes. They won't find out about it for 50 years. And then we're not going to compensate them for it once they find out about it. So, yeah. Same result, no blood. Love it. What do they say? Mr. Fuller always mentions the Godfather. Blood is a big expense. We just, and the fellow from the University of Virginia, Andrew Carl, think I got his name right. Nick, I got his name correctly. The land was ours. I'll verify, but he was also on in 2015. He said that was his next project, was looking at how white racists, excuse me, race soldiers, how they weaponize taxes, property taxes specifically, and they go after black people. He said exactly what they talked about in Detroit. That is super widespread. He said it's very hard to prove because a lot of times they don't just give the tax records to anybody. So you might have a real hard time being able to even see, wow, they are just going after the Negroes. We are being charged like 500% more than whites. And you wouldn't even know. Very important. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in. That was Mr. Nero. I meant to say that. That was Mr. Nero who dialed in. Dr. Shahrzad Ali was on the second time. We were talking about Trayvon Martin. That was in the middle of the summer of 2013 when he dialed in and was talking about the black female syndicate. And he would wear out and all the rest of it. Fun times. Mr. Nero. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we missed you totally, if you have comments to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. Non-white people under the global system of racist white supremacy do not have the ability to protect themselves, including non-white black males. That's one of the reasons why that I am not comfortable in even publicly talking about firearms or going to a gun range, although I have been, but it's with caution. It's similar to, I can't see that much difference between going around white people with guns than going around white people that are consuming alcohol. I don't know which one is more dangerous than the other, to tell you the truth, or they're quite similar. Moving on. Today, DCS program, we shared in conversation with the young fellows about mental health. It was centered around a real life incident that took place down here in South Florida of a 17-year-old black male that committed suicide via placing himself in front of a train. The family was the care group that he's involved with, that we sometimes call families, was literally suffering. The mom, the attempted mom, was put out, was being put out of the hotel that they were staying in. The deceased black male had just signed a full athletic scholarship to Georgia Tech, but he basically, according to the report, he was more concerned immediately about his personal care group and thought that by him going off to quote-unquote school that it would be a hindrance to him participating in the immediate issues involving his care group. Mr. Clark actually was asked by the mom, and he assisted her by getting her a job, by helping her get a job being employed by another non-white black male that's a close associate of his. But her complaint was the money was not coming in soon enough. And as we know, in those times, you know, the children suffer. They also are emotionally detached. And then, of course, this sibling, I guess, was detached to the point to whereas he got to the point to whereas he just decided to end his life in regards to assuming that in regards to by doing that, it was somehow assist the issue. Wasn't able to reach out to anybody before he made that decision. Nevertheless, that was discussed with these younger non-white black males. The whole issue that what you were talking about I don't even know how to describe it, actually. So before I get it all processed, I just won't say anything at all about it. But nevertheless, that's my report for the day so far. Thank you.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter. That is, wow. That is devastating. They just had a report, several reports. They were talking about an increase in suicides among black children. And I was trying to get one of the authors. These are like major reports that were looking at this trend. And I was trying to get one of the authors of the study on the program. But that is, wow.
Especially with black males, it rose to a very high level. Especially with young black males. Yes, sir.
Wow. That is the system of white supremacy. That is why we should have some urgency about, you know, trying to go about solving this problem. That is exactly what is supposed to happen under this system. And life expectancy. Mentioned that at the beginning of the program. Other folks, much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who we have not heard from at all. Number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks we've missed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Steph, and greetings to all the callers on the line. I'm glad you're getting better. I hope that that continues. I actually have more to say on is it Michelle Johnson? Yes?
Michelle Cassandra Johnson, Michelle Johnson, either or.
Yeah. Her commentary, because I wanted to say that one clear indication that her commentary was misandrous is that she prescribed, no, she did not. She mentioned, I'll put it that way, she mentioned that she mentioned that someone, herself at least, should have love, compassion, and forgiveness for racists, but not her own father. It's like, so they get love, compassion, forgiveness, and your father, he get a shot. Did your father pull you over for nothing and threaten to kill you? No, but that race soldier did in September. And you talking about love, compassion, and forgiveness for race soldiers, but you can't even do that for your own father. And I'm not saying this to disparage her or anything like that. I'm just saying it to emphasize the misandrist tone in her book. Also, just the fact that she said that she, like, she admitted that that may, that that was, that they may have been, that misandry may have been the impact of her book and of all these examples that you mentioned when she was on the program. Well, in my view, and if it were me, if that was not my intent, I would have said exactly what Mark Crutcher said to you. And it's just so funny that you mentioned him. He said that a conclusion that you came to when he was on the program, that you were so far off into left field that you couldn't even see home plate, and that what you said was so preposterous and that he didn't know how to respond, and it was so unbelievable, and your powers, your, quote, powers of deductive reasoning are so deficient, and that he had never heard anyone leap to the conclusions that you did based on absolutely nothing, and that your powers of deductive reasoning are deficient in general, that you, that he would have a hard time thinking that you have, that you can reason about anything. That's what he said on the program. Also, in terms of even her, she could just have problems with just her father in general because, you know, as she says that he wasn't there. That actually could have been her mother's fault. I have seen so much of that, where the mothers, like, they get mad at the father or whatever, and they keep their children away from them. And then she said about how, you know, black men are murdered so much and abused so much that, you know, it's hard to keep up with the names and this, that, and the other. Well, if that's the case, then why you bring them up in the first place, if that is the case? And again, you know, with all this stuff about so-called sexism, which doesn't exist, and all of that, just like you said, it's all this say her name type stuff. But you say that, people say that sexism is ubiquitous, but yet we talking about say her name. Well, how come we're not applying that same standard to sexism, so-called sexism? How come we're not applying that standard that, you know what, it's so ubiquitous, it happens so much that, you know, we can't say the names because it's too much going on. And I personally think that she knew the names of, she remembered the names of Alton. I don't know her, but I do believe that she remembered the names of Alton and Philando Castile. I think that those murders were just so controversial and embarrassing to race soldiers that I think she knew not to be very specific about those particular murders. And the reason that I believe this, and I'm almost done, is because to me, she just displayed so much clarity. I think that she knows a lot more about white supremacy than she, to me, pretends to be more confused than she is in order for her to continue to have the relationships with the white people that she has relationships with so that she can continue to probably financially support herself. And she even mentioned talking about going along to get along. I think she does a lot of that. And I think another example of just a lot of clarity that she displayed is just even in her own story, where she wrote on her blog about her, about being pulled over by race soldiers in September. And the last thing that I just wanted to say is that I hope, you know, everybody has a good weekend, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I do remember Mark Crutcher saying that about Gus T. Absolutely. It was right as he was departing. I think he had already had his kerfuffle with Cree. And I think the metaphor I used was that it was like, who's going to be the football? Who's going to control the football in controlling the Negroes? Let's see if we can do this documentary and get more black people to join with us and be against abortion. And that was when he launched into his whole tirade. But good old Mark Crutcher, Ma'afa 21, 2000, December 2009. Way, 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 way back. Been here a long time.
Gus?
Yes, ma'am. Ivy?
Just quickly, I've been wanting to say this for years. The reason he said all that is because you gave him that work, pardon the metaphor. He said all that because what you said, the way that you was able to interpret everything that he said, and his, you were able to just, I'm trying to say this without using a metaphor, to expose everything that he's about and everything that the so-called pro-life movement is about, and that's why he became speechless. Not because your reasoning was off or because it was bad or faulty, but because it was very, very accurate. It was incredible the conclusion that you came to and how you were able to, I hope this isn't a metaphor, read or understand his whole, everything that he was about and the information that he gave you, how you were able to come to the conclusion that you came to. And I'll mute my line. I'm sorry about that.
Ma'afa 21, I do remember it well. The documentary and then his performance. I think that for sure is what that one was, his performance. On the broadcast, should be in the archives, December 2009. Whew. Long, long time. Thought we'd have this problem solved by now. Other folks, we missed totally. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. Again, thank you, Gus, for the platform. I didn't get a chance to listen to a lot of the excerpts today. It's just family time. But I did want to comment on Michelle Johnson. I listened a lot. I was on for that show and listened to the way that it was conducted. It was very professional. She also, I felt, was very patient and gave up a lot of her time. And I think, as you know, and I'm speaking candidly, someone who has been in a tragic arrangement, I think that coming out of that confusion, that level of confusion, can be very difficult. And I think that when she was asked those questions, she could have easily attacked verbally people who were get defensive during the interview, but she didn't. She was very open, and I was kind of surprised. It showed some kind of maturity and understanding, and I appreciated that aspect of the interview. And I think, again, you did an excellent job because you didn't quote unquote attack her verbally during that process. And I think that it's one of those interviews to actually go back and definitely, I mean, all the interviews are worth going back and listening to, but I think that was a very informative one, especially when she spoke about different aspects like the breath. But that's my take on it. I don't think that anything was incorrect in that. The other thing was about what firefighter spoke about. And this was, it's interesting now because I'm reading Revolutionary Suicide, and he just spoke about suicide rates going up. And part of the reason why Huey P. Newton wrote the book was he read an article in 1970 in the issue of Ebony Magazine, when they probably wrote more constructive things, by Lacey Banco and Dr. Herbert Hinden about the rate of black people in major America cities have their rate of suicide doubling, and mainly black men between the ages of 15 and 35 had doubled in the past 10 to 15 years, surpassing the rate of whites in that same age range. And I think that's something to be noted, because I wonder if that after the 70s, at that time frame, did it drop and then it come back as of recently, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, because it seemed like it had to have dropped at one point or another. At least I'm guessing, based on, well, logically, just taking a shot at, because what we're seeing right now with another rise, it seems like this is apparently coming back, which means the mental conditions and the frustration that we're dealing with is just amplified and getting worse. But I'd like to, if possible, Gus, can I say one two lines from the book that I think would be constructive in regards to what Fire Marshal, Firefighter was speaking about.
Dr. Newton's revolutionary suicide?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, let's hear it. Yes, let's hear it, sir.
This is page 3, first chapter. It's at the top. It says, "I do not think that life will change for the better without an assault on the establishment, which goes on exploiting the wretched of the earth. This belief lies at the heart of the concept of revolutionary suicide. Thus, it better to oppose the forces that would drive me to self-murder than to endure them. Although I risk the likelihood of death, there is at least the possibility, if not the probability, of changing the intolerable conditions." And that's all right there. I'll mute my line.
Reading is more important than watching television. We should read that for the book club. I had thought about that for the 50-year anniversary of the Black Panther Party. Talk about black males not being able to protect themselves. Excellent illustration, the Black Panther Party. A bold-faced print, underline that. Got second from retired firefighter. Thank you. Excellent illustration. But we should read that. Revolutionary Suicide. We should read that for the book club. Other folks, much obliged, sir. Thank you for the reading section as well. Other folks that we have missed totally, we have 30 minutes left, so I'll give my prompt again, hopefully. We will not wait, still have time, but should not be waiting until we have 5 minutes, and then I am ready to share about 30 things. If we missed you totally, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Are we? So did any other folks have any extra additional comments that they wanted to get in? I got one of the books from my wish list at Amazon.com. I was so The People Could Fly. I have to go pull it in front of me so I could see the author. The People Could Fly. It is amazing. It's a children's book, and it has lots of short stories. I love short stories because, you know, you can read two or three of them and, you know, and then pick up the next day. But it's short stories. It's illustrated. It has black illustrators, and these are black folk tales and short stories that have been passed on. Like, it's so impressive. I wish I'd had a book. I would have read more when I was younger if I had books like this to pick from. But I was so pleased I got that from my wish list this week. The People Could Fly. I will go grab it and see if I can get the authors. Now, I saw it at the Seattle Public Library. Oh, man, I forgot. Make sure I get that in. Man, I didn't have my phone this time last year for Black History Month. I went to the Seattle Public Library. I think I talked about this on the program, but I'm just bringing it up now because of the report that we ended with about black female authors. No issue there. We're reading Harriet A. Washington right now. Second time around, we don't even read authors repeatedly in the book club. But I went to the Seattle Public Library, the Capitol Hill branch. They had a display for Black History Month. There was not one black male author listed. They had LGBT black authors, black female authors. If it had just been littered with Dr. Welsing, Harriet A. Washington, I probably wouldn't have said anything. But I mean, if you can go and find every LGBT and queer and any other representative to put up, but you can't find one black male author to put a book up for Black History Month, come on. And I did go say something, and they did change it. Next time, I think I came back within 2 days, and they had a number of black male authors posted. But I was just like, geez, like what? Black Miss Andre. Let's see. Any other folks have additional comments that they wanted to get in?
Well, as predicted, thus, Donald Trump has dragged up the white supremacists. We've got in Charlottesville. We've got now this thing going down in Virginia. And I must say, I'm loving it. So, you know, whites want to fight the Second Amendment thing and make parts of Virginia make their own rules and getting government pushback. And I hear West Virginia say, hey, it's okay, just come over here to us and we'll let you do what you want to do. So very interesting. And I think we can say pretty much as predicted from the campaign of 2016-15, what we were seeing from the crowds, that this was going to be very polarizing. And I think a lot of it's been kept out of the mainstream television. But now we're seeing white supremacist cells being busted by the FBI. Like, whoa, cells, like terrorist cells. I can't even think of anything else they use that word for other than terrorists. But, you know, they're not calling them terrorists, but just waiting for them to commit a terrorist act and see what happens. But the focus has been mostly on the black identity extremists, as, you know, as white supremacists do. They divert the attention. But I think that whatever they're trying to keep from happening in Virginia, they it's something that they don't want people to see. So they're trying to stop it before it even happens. And I just think it's very interesting. And I blame no one but Donald Trump. You know, prior to Donald Trump, what we saw was black people shot. And now we get the white people fighting each other. I'm totally okay with this. Also, back to the guest who got the dates wrong, the year wrong, that Philando Castile and the brother in Louisiana were killed, murdered by the police. It seems like such a thing to get wrong, because the consequences for that act led to several police officers being killed in both Dallas and then Louisiana. I believe in Dallas it was like 5 cops that were shot dead at a rally for Philando Castile. So it just seems like one of those things that just shouldn't get wrong.
I agree. Just on the like, in terms of context, that's a part of how Donald Trump got to the White House. All of that happened the summer. That's part of how I remember it. All of that happened the summer of 2016. That ended up influencing what Donald Trump said when he accepted the Republican nomination. Didn't he have Sheriff Clark? That's my favorite. They used to talk about him every day. You don't even hear his name now. Sheriff Clark in Wisconsin came out and spoke law and order. It's a war on the police, and we're not going to tolerate it. That Micah Exay, all of that was huge in terms of how we have our current president. Let's see. Other folks who, if you have additional comments, questions you want to add.
Yes, I've still been processing the subject of black males as far as being protective. I would say the most logical means of that subject would be to, in a constructive manner, sharing information such as logic and codified counter-racist information with that black female, whether it's your offspring or whoever, as far as that concerned, sharing knowledge about eating properly, exercise, that sort of thing, as far as protection is concerned. As far as firearms and whatnot, if I'm in a position where I have to use a firearm, I don't need to be in that environment anyway, in the first place. Although some things are unexpected, but for the most part, just sharing with that person that deserves your concern, sharing with them, codification. It really is the best means of what a non-white person can do with another non-white person, period, whether it's male, female, male, you know, whatever. Hopefully I'm making some sense in what I'm saying. Thank you.
Logical, life-saving information. Absolutely. Love it. Love it, love it, love it. And even just hanging out
in a constructive manner. I can deal that
exactly.
As well. I can dig that as well. Hopefully,
it would lower your chances for something negatively physically taking help happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. We have been pretty harmonious at the yoga retreats thus far. I said very proudly, we were balanced, males and females, when we were in Virginia. A little more male in Florida, but we had a smaller group. The folks that are already signing up, money-wise, it's a little more female this time, but it's early. We'll see what the final tally looks like, February 29, but it has been super harmonious at the yoga retreats, and we've done a lot of what retired firefighters, I think we did everything retired firefighter just said, talking about protection, talking about racism, talking about healthy things to eat, things not to eat, exercise. I think we did everything that retired firefighter just mentioned. Constructive exchanges of views, absolutely spectacular. Looking forward to doing it again, May 21 to May 24. Maybe sweet potato pie. I did say that might be signature for the retreats. I have gotten very good at sweet potato pie, but I can make lots of things. Springtime, spring fruits. They might have fresh blueberries again. If they have fresh blueberries, blueberry cobbler. Anyway, other folks have comments that they wanted to get in.
Abby, yeah.
Yes, ma'am. Ivy.
VGQ, you, but I don't think you should, and I don't think you need to defend yourself when people, I guess, take issue with you bringing up Black misandry and you pointing out examples of that. Because just like Shahrazad Ali said, Black women haven't been examined. In terms of our conduct, you get all this talk about victimization and how, you know, men are victimizing us, but never about how we victimizing them, never how, you know, we rape boys and we rape men and force them to penetrate, never how we hit men so much. I mean, that is just so, there's so much violence of women against men, and that is not talked about, and I think far more of that than men against women, because it's not as it's just not as talked about. I'll put it that way, and I'll leave that alone. And I think also when you or anyone, when a man defends himself against accusations of, you know, hating women or whatever, just because he brought up examples of women misbehaving and mistreating other men, I think it says that, or it makes it appear as though you owe some sort of explanation and you have to give an account each and every time you point out Black misandry. And that's just not true. Another thing I want to say about Mark Crutcher, he did all that. He just had a whole lot of ad hominem attacks. He did all those things that I mentioned in terms of, you know, what I quoted about what he said about you, but he had no defense for the conclusions that you came to. All he just said was that, you know, your reasoning was bad and this and that, but he couldn't prove it at all. You said a long time ago that any non-white person that anyone thinks has surpassed white people in any area of people activity can be, I don't know if shut down is a metaphor, but basically they can be silenced for lack of words, or everything that they're doing can be stopped. There we go. In under 30 minutes by a small number of white people. One specific example of that is the music industry. We had this legacy of just being these great artists, and then what white people did is they killed a bunch of our artists, and then replaced them with a bunch of people that have no talent. And so now people think that Black people are terrible hip-hop artists, terrible singers, and all these different things. And at least if that's not the perception now,
it will be very soon if we don't solve this problem. I want to say also that Khalid Browder, I think he was murdered. I don't think he spent all that time, spent the time or whatever in jail, then come out, you know, and he was innocent, then come out and then he gets murdered. Or he comes out and commits suicide. No, I just don't think so. I think the race soldiers murdered him. I think boogeyman is a racist term because black people, they say boogie. That's like a slang term for us. So I think boogeyman, I think that's what that is, just like Scooby-Doo. Black people are chided for emphasizing money. Money is a need. You're not going to live without it. So anybody who emphasizes money has their priorities straight. Another thing I wanted to say is that white people are always lying about all of their statistics, and they're always lying about suicide and always trying to compare it to white people. White people are the ones that are killing themselves, and if anything, they say the things that they say, and they how can I put this? They manipulate the data. I'm almost done talking. They manipulate the data. In a variety of ways, which I don't have time to go into because I've been talking too long as it is. But I think what it is with them is that they want to increase our suicide, and that's why they put these numbers out here the way that they do. I think the concept of black male privilege is put out there to stop stop people from talking about the way black men are lynched so much. And I think that's all I'll say for now. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Duff.
Much obliged, boogeyman. I will have to ponder on that one. I had not thought of that before. Other folks, much obliged, Ivy. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, we have 15 minutes left in the broadcast, and or if you have any additional comments you want to share, 15 minutes. Let's see. Everybody satisfied? Nothing else they wanted to make sure they get in?
I see they have coming out now, transgenic, it's called transgenic sound. It's genetically modified organ, completely created organisms that they sell as salmon. And when you use transgenic, that means that you're taking, let's just say, some dog DNA and mixing it with the salmon to add whatever to it. You know, it, transgenic means you took another species DNA and mixed it with another species DNA. So just be on the lookout for transgenic salmon. It's been FDA approved. It's supposed to be in stores very soon.
Plant-based meals at the counter-racist retreat. Wow. They go out and poison the entire known universe and then eat up all the fish, have everybody eating up all the fish, so you run out of salmon. Now you got to come up with all these kooky ways to go in and manufacture some pseudo-salmon. Plant-based. Hopefully we can do plant-based and organic for everything. Heading to Toronto, May 21 through May 24. Let's see. If any other folks have additional comments, questions, they want to make sure they get in, feel free. It was... I'm supposed to get the book. Man, I am so tired. I have been in my bed the entire time we've been on the air and pretty much for the most of the last 2 days. And that book is about... I'm going to say 7 feet from where I am seated on the bed, and it feels like it is about 70 yards to get to that book. Like, whoo! I wish I had one of those grabber things that I could just kind of reach out and boop. But The People Could Fly, I do know the name of it. It is spectacular. If you have offspring, we talked about that previously. Literature for black children, bang, that is absolutely one. Love the illustrations, and it's big. Well, I mean, not like
the size of the Bible big, but it's a larger book, so there are a lot of stories in it and lots of pictures. Like, it's awesome. The people could fly. I'll hopefully muster up the energy to see if I can take these five steps to grab it. I can tell you the author as well. Oh, I could just look online for that. Yeah, that's The People Could Fly. Spectacular. If you have literature, that's something as well. Like, we talk about you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. It could take a while to build up a library for your children. I've been around Black Parent. I mean, when I say a while, sometimes it can take years to accumulate books that you would want Black children to read. That alone can take up quite a bit of time. So, yeah, there are lots of things to do and plan before getting to the children part. When you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. Was that somebody else had commentary they wanted to share? No, okay. Let's see. The People Could Fly. Let's see. Mute button.
The very last thing.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Very last thing. I saw where Odell Beckham tapped a cop on the butt after the national championship game, and the cop tried to charge him with sexual assault. And I said, wow. You know, it was like a tap on the butt, like you see football players do, and it was a male cop. But sexual assault.
Wow. Odell Beckham, I saw it looked like they were attempting to do lots of things to say that he had committed some sort of wrongdoing. I didn't know about that with the enforcement official, but they had a picture. He's an alumnus of LSU. They won the national championship, and so he was there with the team celebrating afterwards. And they had pictures. They said he was giving the LSU players wads of cash, which is, they have a lot of rules with the NCAA, so that's type of thing is supposed to be illegal. They've gotten lots and lots and lots of Black males in trouble for that sort of thing. Ruin their careers sometimes. You put some of them in jail. They got a big group of them charged for that right now. But I saw that and was like, oh, wow, that's, you don't want that. They take that sort of thing real serious. They've even vacated national championships and all kinds of things. Like, man, whew, get out of Louisiana, Odell Beckham Jr. Get back to Cleveland. Get ready for next season. Virginia Hamilton, that's her name. The People Could Fly, Virginia Hamilton. She's a Black female. The People Could Fly is spectacular. You can get it on Amazon. Should be available on other book sites. It's not super old. I don't think you should have like trouble getting it from a bookstore. It seems like they should be able to order it or what have you. But wow, I am super impressed. If I had children, I would definitely want this book in my library for them to read. Anything else folks need to get in before we get ready to wrap up?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to first start out with the segment about, I think that may have been a Black female that was talking about, I think her offspring had asthma. I think it was worsening as a result of living in a household that I guess wasn't up to the standards of healthy living conditions. I think the mold and whatnot. I definitely came up in those kinds of conditions, and they can be very effective on your health. It can have an adverse effect. But I remember her saying that she had to call in, I think, 27 times, and her child had to miss 27 days. Just that kind of report shows the reality of living in a system of white supremacy. And you were speaking about the passports. I'm noticing that there are a lot of people coming in with Trump, President Trump, T-shirts, hats, other paraphernalia, and I don't know if they're expecting me to react a certain way. I just act with courtesy had to take a person's picture for his passport, and he was wearing a Trump T-shirt. So I was just courteous. He was courteous, whatever. But I'm thinking in their mind, they're like, oh, we got this black person in here. We got black people in here. So we'll see how this goes. And they're very bold with wearing this this material. And as far as the black male being able to protect himself, I'm not in a position to do that. And I'm thinking about there was the racism that was occurring at Syracuse University. There was a black female that said, I hate it here, and this racism is just too much, it's overwhelming. And then the black male was saying he was victimized so much that he said that he couldn't tell you how many times he was crying in his girlfriend's arms because of the racism. And then his mom had got cancer, and she was trying to get him to stay there, and he didn't want to be there. So just constant tragic terrorism that black people have to face in a white supremacist system. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
That is extra clowning. I'm going to wear my MAGA shirt to get my passport photo. Like, wow. Like, for the next decade, when I travel the globe, yes, indeed, I support our man. I love it. I love it. Even the fact that they're doing, like, I think for most, I was thinking I just wanted to wear a shirt that didn't have anything on it. I'm not wearing my cow shirt to take my passport photo. Like, man, the living man. We are reading Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism. We just got started. We've read not even two chapters, and I said, wow, Harriet A. Washington might have two books in Gus's top 10. That is amazing. Medical Apartheid in my top 5, A Terrible Thing to Waste. I am, well, I don't know. I was going to say I'm very certain she'll cover the asthma component, but I don't think she will, because her book is on how all of this pollution and toxification ends up destroying your brain. So maybe she won't deal with the asthma. I would suspect she might be a sentence in there. We'll have to see. But Freddie Gray is coming up this here Thursday. That's our next segment. Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Freddie Gray, Baltimore. Anything else folks want to get in? We have about 3 minutes left. Folks are satisfied. That is grand as well. I felt like there was one other thing I was going to include. It escapes me. I will add, I don't have Netflix, but it's such a force in the system. Reading is more important than watching television. But I'm aware of the things that people end up watching. I said I saw Aaron Hernandez. Since I've been in bed for the past 48 hours, I saw the Netflix documentary on Aaron Hernandez. And I just thought about some of the most popular segments that I have heard about. They generally deal with killing. I don't think we often reflect on talks about toxification, being in an environment where you are just constantly saturated with killing and murders, unjust killings, all the time. This is entertainment. In a system of justice, would that be entertainment? You come in, we're going to sit around and watch something, and we're going to watch a film about a guy that has gone out and killed a bunch of people. Unjustly. Got away with it, maybe. Just thinking of how many of them it is on that. I think most of the pop, if I even took a second, I think, to look at most of their really popular Netflix series, killing. That lets you know the type of environment that we're in right there. Would that be normal? Would that be ubiquitous? Everything that is a top hit bestseller is about doing some killing, hacking up some people, stabbing up some folks.
System. Can I say something, Gus?
Thomas in New York.
Oh, yeah. Just to let you know, Netflix, which now has quite a few competitors, though, Hulu and
Amazon
Peacock being rolled out by Universal, and I believe with stuff Disney Plus. But however, they just came out and said they're spending $17 billion on content next year, so expect more hacking and stealing. The next competitor is only spending $2 billion, so they'll have a whole bunch of it.
More killing, more killing, more hacking. That's what that's going to be. They'll have the Dylan Roof story and all the rest of it. That is the Central Park Five, lots of those. Anywho, we will be back. I'm hopefully going to be feeling better and can get up.
Sure.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I wanted to ask you this. Do you think that it's enough self-care that you still go through with the programs when you been in bed all day? That you've had that a number of times where you had to be in bed all day. So I wanted to know, do you think that? And also, what goes into your, I guess, decision to just go through with the program, even though you've been sick all day or for 2 days or a week or whatever it is? I mean, a lot.
I felt like if I stayed in bed, I could broadcast from bed. I did that yesterday. The audio clips, I felt like I wouldn't have to. Talking takes a lot of energy. Michael Bradley said that is one thing that we agree on, author of The Iceman Inheritance. Talking takes a lot of energy, so for this program, I don't have to talk too much with the audio clips, and then people generally aren't spectating. They weren't today, so I don't have to talk a whole lot. And I can stay in bed, which I did today. The Michelle Cassandra Johnson, that would have probably been a little more challenging if I had not been feeling well, but as long as I feel like I can still be present, I'm not nodding off or in such discomfort that I'm not paying attention to what's being said, that proceed. Let's be about the business of solving this problem immediately.
Okay, thank you.
We'll have tomorrow off to be in bed or lounge around, get my energy, get the reserves up, and we will be ready to remain on the counter-racist grind. You can check Facebook, Black Talk Radio Network, for updates for the upcoming broadcasts. We have a white woman coming to the program shortly. Always enjoy when we have racist man, racist woman directly to talk to. But we'll have dates for that. The Toronto Yoga Retreat, we are coming. Get your passport, May 21 through May 24, Thursday through Sunday. Plant-based meals, yoga, counter-racist workshops, food workshops. Looking forward to having a great time while visiting Toronto in late spring. Drop an email if you need info, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Preserve our brain computer, Harriet A. Washington. She said, a part of the environmental racism and pollution of areas where black people are allowed to stay, noxious alcohols. That was the verbiage that Harriet A. Washington used in A Terrible Thing to Waste. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up. Every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver, let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with the Amber Geigers, Daniel Holtzclaws of the known universe. In addition to being sober and buckled up, if you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, just trying to do the small things that we can to minimize contact. Race soldiers try to keep ourselves as safe as possible under conditions designed to be dangerous for black people. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice
immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.